rarely heard BBC archive.
He said he had no quarrel with the Viet Cong.
If I had two, I would have went to jail.
Express yourself!
The Louisville Lip on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I told you, I'm the real champion! I told you, I'm the champion of the world!
This Saturday night at 8.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday the 28th of May. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
The headlines today, a major review of youth unemployment is warning that the UK faces a lost generation with young people failed by a system stuck in the past. We'll speak with the author of the review, the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn, and hear from young people struggling to get a foot on the career ladder.
It's not aiming too high to want to go beyond being a cafe worker if you're overqualified to be a cafe worker. And it's not fair to put yourself in so much debt with university and to not be given the opportunity afterwards to get into the workforce.
The US and Iran have traded attacks, raising fears the fragile ceasefire could collapse. A former US national security official tells us neither side is clear on how, if and when they want this conflict to end.
What is interesting is that there seem to be as many differences about how this war should end within Iran and the US as there are between Iran and the US.
Also in today's programme, we'll bring you the news of who has won the prestigious Sound of the Year award. Past winners include audio of refugees crossing through checkpoints, sounds of polling stations and Lime bikes being stolen in London. And
one of my recent tricks is to find any weird chord that I don't even know what it is. So anyway, I just went...
The master of sound, Sir Paul McCartney, lets us in on his songwriting process. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
The author of a government-commissioned review says there's a risk of a lost generation in the UK unless urgent action is taken to ensure more young people are either earning or learning. An interim report by the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn says 16 to 24-year-olds are being let down by a system stuck in the past and warns that the number of those who are not in education, employment or training could increase to 1.25 million within 5 years. Our employment correspondent Zoe Conway reports.
Alan Milburn paints a bleak picture. He says young people have been failed by the state for years. Schools, the health system, the welfare state are no longer fit for purpose, he warns, and need far-reaching reform. He says there's nothing temporary about the problem of young people not earning or learning. Without urgent action, he says, one in six 16 to 24-year-olds will not be in education or the workplace in 5 years' time. Mr. Milburn dismissed the idea that young people are snowflakes. He said they were anxious, and the overwhelming majority of those not working wanted jobs. His report is expected to say there are 1.6 million fewer low and medium-skilled roles in the economy. The government said it welcomed the report and said it was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation.
The United States has carried out fresh strikes against Iran hours after President Trump warned he was not satisfied with the terms of a proposed peace deal. A US official said the actions were purely defensive and intended to maintain the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. State media says Iran's Revolutionary Guards targeted a US airbase in response but gave no further details. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
This is the second time in 3 days that the US has attacked targets in Iran. The US shot down four one-way attack drones it said posed a threat over the Strait of Hormuz. The military then conducted airstrikes against an Iranian ground control station that was about to fire a fifth drone. On Monday, the United States struck missile launch sites and Iranian boats it said were trying to lay mines in the strait, where thousands of commercial tanker ships are stranded as a result of the conflict. The renewed hostilities threaten the fragile ceasefire between Iran and America as the two nations continue negotiations to end the war. Yesterday, President Trump said he was not yet satisfied with the terms of a deal, warning that if he doesn't get what he wants, America will, in his words, just finish the job in Iran.
Further, Israeli strikes have hit in and around the southern Lebanese city of Tyre after Israel's military issued evacuation orders for swathes of the country's south. The areas covered by the warnings account for more than one-eighth of Lebanon's territory. Our correspondent John Sudworth reports from Beirut.
Social media videos from Tyre, one of Lebanon's biggest cities, shows dust-covered crowds of people gathered around collapsed buildings and with the fires being fought by rescue workers illuminating the night. The tens of thousands of residents were given a warning to leave just 2 hours before the strikes began. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this week that he will smite the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in response to its use of deadly new fibre-optic drones.
The boss of Britain's biggest house builder says first-time buyers are living through one of the most challenging times to purchase a home. David Thomas, the chief executive of Barratt Redrow, says rising interest rates, student loan deductions and wages not keeping up with inflation are factors hitting younger buyers particularly hard. He told the BBC that those hoping to get on the housing ladder faced conditions comparable with only the period after the 2008 financial crisis.
Certainly it's going to be close to where we were in terms of the post the great financial crisis. Now that was probably more to do with lending, but I think it's very, very comparable for first-time buyers. And we're now facing challenges around affordability with no government support scheme in place.
The government said it was helping thousands save for their first home through the Lifetime ISA and supporting more buyers to get a mortgage. Former workers on the Channel 4 reality show Married at First Sight UK have told BBC News that senior staff had an unhealthy focus on whether cast members were having sex. The claims follow a Panorama investigation into welfare standards on the series. Here's our culture correspondent Noor Nanji.
Several of the former workers we spoke to said there was an emphasis on sex from the outset of filming a new series of Married at First Sight UK. One said crew members made bets on which couple would sleep together first, although they weren't for money. We also heard that producers manufactured confrontations between cast members. Lawyers for the production company say cast members are not pressured in any way, and it doesn't recognise the allegation that staff took bets on couples having sex. CPL also refutes any suggestion it prioritises entertainment over the welfare of contributors. Channel 4 has commissioned an external review of contributor welfare on Maths UK.
The BBC has learned that Birmingham City Council has paid itself nearly £500,000 in daily charges and fines over the past 5 years because many of its vehicles breach the rules of its own clean air zone. The council is also unable to spend the money as it wishes, as Alex Homer explains.
Birmingham's clean air zone came into effect in June 2021. The BBC used an environmental information regulations request to learn that, between then and the end of March this year, the City Council had paid £470,000 in charges and fines for non-compliant vehicles. After the operating costs of the zone, some of the money it generates goes to central government, while the rest must be spent on transport or environmental schemes. The council says replacing a large number of vehicles is not a simple undertaking, but it's working at pace to upgrade the rest of its fleet.
Alex Homer reporting.
Thanks very much, Jane. It is 7 minutes past six. Let's find out just how hot it will be today. Stav's at the Weather Centre. Morning, Stav.
Good morning to you, Johnny and Nick. Thank you very much. Well, it was a noisy night for some parts of England and Wales last night as showers and thunderstorms trundled their way northwards, giving some much-needed downpours in places. At the moment, we've got some thundery downpours through parts of the North Midlands, Northern England and towards Lincolnshire. They'll continue to advance northwards and clear out into the North Sea over the next few hours. And then we're all looking at a fine morning, plenty of sunshine, a little bit more humid than it was yesterday. And it's going to be a warmer day. We've got south southeasterly wind, so it's going to be warmer across the southeast. And now as we head through the afternoon, we'll start to see a bit of cloud rolling into central southern England and Wales, also Northern Ireland. There could be the odd shower out of this, but most places will stay sunny and very warm into the afternoon. Temperatures reach the mid to high 20s for many, the high teens, low 20s across northern and western Scotland, and across the south and southeast of England, the highest temperatures again we could be exceeding the 30 Celsius mark. Once again, 30 or 31 degrees will be the high. And then as we head into tonight, any evening showers die away, but we'll start to see rain pushing to Northern Ireland and Scotland. But for most of England and Wales, Northern Ireland, it should be another fairly mild night. With temperatures around that low to mid-teens. Friday, though, it's a different story. England and Wales mainly dry with some sunshine, the odd shower, but Scotland and Northern Ireland will begin to see stronger southwesterly winds with outbreaks of rain.
Stav, thank you very much indeed. It's now 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Daily Mail describes Alan Milburn's report on youth inactivity as sobering. We'll be hearing from him at 8:10. The paper warns that the UK is already in a worse position than Greece, France and Spain. Writing in The Sun, Mr Milburn calls it a quiet crisis happening in homes across Britain. He acknowledges what he calls the government's serious steps in the right direction, but stresses these changes must now adapt to something bigger. In an article for The Times, Keir Starmer advocates for a truly national endeavour to deliver a new deal for young people. The founder of The Big Issue, Lord Bird, writes in the Daily Mirror that the government must confront the link between growing up in poverty and difficulties securing employment or education.
Well, sources have told The Guardian that the UK's vetting agency flagged Lord Mandelson's associations with senior figures in China, Russia and Israel shortly before he became Britain's ambassador to the US. Separately, the Daily Telegraph understands messages to be released next week are expected to show that the peer gave advice to cabinet ministers whilst he was in the role. Whitehall sources tell the paper he was not usually consulted on policy issues unless they related to the US. The peer is under criminal investigation over allegations of misconduct in public office and has repeatedly let it be known that he believes he has not acted criminally, did not act for personal gain, and is cooperating with the police.
The Financial Times says President Trump's Board of Peace, which he's hailed as one of the most consequential international organisations created, has no money in its official fund, despite $17 billion being pledged. The paper's been told that the board has received donations via its JP Morgan account rather than into a fund administered by the World Bank. A Board of Peace official tells the FT that a number of options were established to receive funding.
And according to The Eye, Armando Iannucci, the co-creator of the very sweary BBC political satire The Thick of It, is set to pen, wait for it, the next Paddington film. The paper warns that the bear could be in for a more intense dressing down than Mrs. Bird's mild scolding. The Guardian notes Paddington is about to develop a particularly hard stare.
They're ignoring the soft side of Armando. I don't think he'll do anything of the sort. He'll treat him with huge respect. It's coming up to 12 minutes past six.
There is the rather ominous sound of borders and airports closing to the Democratic Republic of Congo as both neighbours and those further afield take fright at the Ebola outbreak on the east of the vast nation. Uganda shut its borders with DRC yesterday. The US is planning to have its affected citizens treated in Kenya rather than repatriated. Marco Rubio, United States Secretary of State, chose to raise the issue of Ebola in a news conference last night.
The number one priority of our foreign policy is to protect the American people. We cannot and will not allow any cases of Ebola to enter the United States.
Let's talk to Thomas Makwana, BBC correspondent in Nairobi. Thomas, clearly alarm is spreading about the possible movement of this strain of Ebola out of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah, John, yeah, and you said it rightly. So the United States government has said that it will not allow any infected persons into its borders, and this just extends the list further into 11 or more countries which have so far implemented the restrictions from people traveling from DRC, Uganda and South Sudan, which are the epicenter of this current outbreak. No case in South Sudan yet, but 7 recorded across the border in Uganda's capital, Kampala. And in DRC, it's getting worse over time. So around 1,000 people suspected to have been infected so far. But the worst figure is that only 20% of those people who came into contact with those confirmed cases or suspected cases can be traced. And this leads to this points to a much bigger problem of insufficient contact tracing, which is supposed to be the number one step of stopping the spread of this virus. And around 220 people suspected to have died so far. But a testing problem also exists, because just 17 people of those who've died have been confirmed to be positive Ebola cases, and just 121 confirmed cases. We spoke to experts, and they say just 6 people can be tested a day, no, an hour. And if you do the math, around 1,000 people suspected to have been infected. How long would that take to test all those people? So there's a huge testing problem and a logistics problem in DRC right now, and these countries are taking notice.
And getting in the way of contact tracing is the conflict in eastern DRC. The World Health Organization has called for a ceasefire, it's very clear that nearly everyone who understands what's going on there thinks that the conflict is making this worse.
Yeah, absolutely. The WHO Director General has called for a ceasefire, but that's hard to make true because you're dealing with so many rebel groups. Ituri province, that is at the center of this outbreak, that province, a good section of it, is not controlled by the DRC government. It's controlled by ADF. There are frequent attacks, mostly against Christians there, and it's a jihadist movement. Up near the border with Rwanda, there is M23 controlling Goma, where several cases have been reported. So to negotiate a ceasefire amongst all these groups with different interests, all pointing guns at each other, is difficult, and that's a big problem for humanitarian organizations.
Thomas, thank you very much indeed. Thomas Mukwana, our correspondent in Nairobi, and we'll be speaking to the executive director of the WHO Emergencies Programme at 10 to 8.
Time now is 6:15. Britain's biggest council is repeatedly breaching its own clean air rules, and as a result is having to pay huge daily fines, money it then can't spend on its own priorities. The reporter who's discovered this, the senior journalist at the BBC Shared Data Unit in Birmingham, is Alex Homer. What's going on, Alex?
Good morning. So Birmingham City Council is breaching its own clean air zone. It has had to pay itself more than £470,000 in daily charges and fines because its own vehicles aren't meeting these rules. And that's despite the fact it's had this continuous bin strike that many listeners may know about, which has been running since January 2025. Most of the vehicles which have drawn these daily charges are actually from the council's waste department.
And people might think, well, what's the problem? If it finds itself, gets the money back, why should anybody care?
Well, I can see why people would think that, but that would be wrong, because the income from clean air zones, it first has to cover the operating costs of the scheme, which are not insignificant. Then we have to go, there's money paid to government for the government's costs. And then after that, the remainder, that surplus, is actually ring fence for transport and environmental schemes. So it can't be put towards anything else. So you've got this issue where, yes, the council's paying itself, but that money can't then just be distributed on anything.
And a quick final one, Alex, then why don't they simply buy newer vehicles? Money, presumably, is the reason.
Well, you'd think that, again, common sense, but the problem is this is actually rooted, this problem's rooted back several years. The council didn't have a central record of all the vehicles that it owned or hired or leased. So over the past 12 months, it's actually had to work to first get that record and then second, look to start getting these replacement vehicles, you know, electric alternatives for the vehicles they already have. So it's astounding, really, that it's, you know, this clean air zone has been in place since 2021. And we're hearing that it's only in the past 12 months that these replacements have started to happen at pace.
Alex Homer in Birmingham, thank you.
6:17, and the boss of Britain's biggest house builders says that first-time buyers are living through one of the most challenging times ever, with conditions similar to the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. He has been talking to Sean Farrington, who has more on this and the rest of the morning's business news. Good morning, Sean.
Morning, Johnny. Yeah, this is David Thomas, the chief executive of the FTSE 100 company, Barrett Redrow. So that was a company that came into being a couple of years ago after a £2.5 billion merger. He's led the Barrett business and then Barrett Redrow for 11 years, set to retire at the end of this year as well. We touched on lots of different topics, including how a revolution is on the way, which could mean factory production largely replacing bricklaying. We started on the subject of affordability, though. I asked David Thomas if there was a risk of a whole generation being left behind in housing.
Of course there is. You know, if you look at the way that housing purchases, housing starts, home ownership for first-time buyers, the way that the age of the average first-time buyer is increasing and increasing, these are all factors that lead towards generational inequalities.
Put it in a bit of context, given, you know, you've been at Barrett and now Barrett Redrow for 17 years, a large chunk of that as chief executive. Is this the worst time ever to be a first-time buyer?
It's certainly one of the most challenging times. I'm not sure I would try to decide on the worst time ever, but certainly it's going to be close to where we were in terms of the post the great financial crisis. Now, that was probably more to do with lending coming out of 2008, 2009, But I think it's very, very comparable for first-time buyers, in particularly when you look at areas like London and the South East. There was immediately government support put in place in 2009 and thereafter. So we're now facing challenges around affordability with no government support scheme in place. So, yeah, challenging, very, very difficult for first-time buyers.
Many started this year thinking interest rates would fall, and the war in Iran began at the end of February. And we've heard how expectations of interest rates and where they will go have changed throughout the year. You know, depending on who you ask, they might stay about where they are. Some think they might go up. How has that changed the prospects for a young buyer, a first-time buyer this year? What has the war in Iran done to those prospects?
It's been a really dramatic change. Unfortunately, I think if you went back over the last 5 or 6 years, starting the year and being given a certain message and then finding during the year that that message has changed has become more the norm. We were doing our half-year results in February. We were expecting an interest rate reduction in March. The percentage probability of a rate reduction in March, as I remember, was kind of north of 80%, with a further reduction to come in September. And in practice, we've seen a significant rise in, if you look at the two-year fix, we've seen a significant rise as the conflict in the Middle East has taken off. So if you're a first-time buyer, then clearly that's a very dramatically different backdrop, now surrounded with a lot of uncertainty.
How might you think the changes in the jobs market might affect that? Because not only just sort of what we're going through economically and business decisions in reaction to higher prices, government policy, whatever that might be, but the way the world is changing as well. Is there a risk for the housing market there if the growth of artificial intelligence means there's a whole different array of jobs that are out there?
If you look at the industry over the last 20 years, you know, the industry will have been consistently saying we have a lot of challenges around skills. So the availability of skills in terms of young talent coming into the industry is a challenge. If you look at the volumes that would have come into the industry in the 70s and 80s in terms of bricklayers, electricians, plumbers and so on, people coming in on trade apprentices, then we've seen real challenges in terms of maintaining those volumes. There's a much, much wider range of opportunities for young people, whether it be in terms of further education or different jobs, technology jobs, for example, which wouldn't have existed in the same way in the 70s or 80s. So attracting people into the industry is a big challenge, one that we feel the industry is really facing into and is trying to...
Is it, though? I do wonder, because you're about the third boss in the space of a week that we've spoken to who've talked about their industry facing challenges in recruitment. At some point, do you sort of not have to go, the industry hasn't either sold itself well enough, it's not providing people with the opportunities in the right places, you're not reaching the people who could be working for you?
We are out there, we are recruiting, we are trying to expand numbers that we bring in as we seek to grow the business. But also we've got to change methods of production. So more factory-based production. We have, and many of the other house builders have, factories for production that 10 years ago we didn't have. Producing timber frame, for example, in factories, we've got a centre of production and that we're then shipping the frames around the country for production. That can make significant changes to what we're doing on site. So bringing new technologies into our production line is allowing us to reduce labour content on site. So
does that mean fewer staff overall, fewer workers overall?
It will reduce our requirements in terms of on-site employees, switching from on-site to off-site in factories. Because our business is expanding, so we've set out a very clear expansion plan, then we will, in overall terms, be employing more people.
What's the job on-site that you would expect to see fewer of in a few years' time?
The big area that we're challenged with on-site is with regard to bricklayers, for example. So that's been called out in a number of studies as being one of our biggest challenge areas.
But it's also something that can be replaced by factory production.
Correct. And therefore, we can address that. You know, we have a lead time to allow us to address that. And therefore, looking at alternate solutions to bricks.
But is that okay? I know for bricklayers listening to this, there may be concerns about what their skills may be required for. But is that just a natural innovation of industry and an example of how something like AI will replace some of those skills?
I think that is a reasonable illustration of that. So, you know, you see in production now two things. One is bricklaying robots, which in the UK, I would say, have limited application in residential space. But for commercial buildings where you've got maybe a very long run of bricks to be laid, then robots have been used. And then secondly, using alternate cladding products that are, let's say, brick simulation. So both of those are innovations. I think if you're a bricklayer looking at that, certainly any time in the near term, there's not going to be any shortage of demand for bricklayers. That landscape isn't going to change dramatically in the short term. But we need to invest in these factories so that in the medium to long term...
What is medium term?
I would say that 5 to 10 years, and then longer term beyond 10 years. So I think you'll see a revolution beyond 10 years in terms of the way that the industry builds homes on site and the amount of off-site production that takes place.
What would your advice be to a 25-year-old bricklayer at the moment?
It's going to be a very, very good career, because when you look at the shortage of bricklayers and you look at the requirements for bricklayers in all respects, I think it would be a long time before you would be predicting that there is actually too many bricklayers for the work that is required.
You can hear all of that interview with David Thomas, the boss of Barratt Redrow, the FTSE 100 house builder, on BBC Sounds. You know what to search for. Big Boss interview. A government spokesperson said to us when we put some of those points to them that they're supporting first-time buyers through schemes like the Lifetime ISA, for example. Got Laura Lambie here with me, Senior Investment Director at Rathbones. Laura, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Some interesting moves in the league table of supermarkets. Lidl overtaking Morrison's to become the fifth largest supermarket. Is this more a tale of Lidl or Morrison's at the moment?
Bit of both, I think. I mean, Morrison's have struggled a bit with they've got a big debt issue from the 2021 private equity buyout. They've got big interest payments and losses, and they've been forced to cut costs, which I suspect has harmed the customer experience. There's intense competition in this area, and Lidl seem to have done it right. They consistently undercut the traditional supermarkets, and they are still seen by consumers, I think, as being cheap but good. You know, they're more efficient, they have smaller stores, they have simpler operations, they have faster stock turnover. Well, so they have leapfrogged Morrison's in market share.
So if Lidl are on the up like that, Laura, when we had Morrison's just within the last week saying it's planning to close 100 stores over the coming months, and it largely blamed government policy choices for rising costs. Do you have sympathy with that when you see a rival overtaking them at the speed it has?
Well, I suspect if Morrison's is facing increased costs, then so are all its competitors. So I suspect that's not an excuse for being leapfrogged by Lidl. But of course there's increased costs. There's increased inflation, increased business rates. But that, as I say, affects everybody on the high street.
Well, and staying with the high street, Laura, what are Modella Capital up to? So it looks like they're set to acquire Flying Tiger, this Danish headquartered retailer known for stationery and homeware. It's the retail investor behind TG Jones, which had all those WH Smith stores, some of those closing, the original factory shop as well. What's its plan?
Well, it's specifically a UK private equity. They invest their own capital, and this is, I think, part of a continued consolidation in the high street. There's less footfall on the high street, and even quite innovative companies such as Flying Tiger have suffered as less footfall on the high street has impacted their business. So Modella are renowned as turnaround buyers. I have to say they've had mixed success. Mm. You mentioned WH Smith. They also had Claire's Accessories, bought that in 2025, and that eventually went under.
Right.
So let's hope we don't see closures of stores and too many redundancies.
Laura Lambie, thank you for your time this morning, Senior Investment Director at Rathbones.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. He's coming for 6:30. Well, another trophy for an English club. Mike, it's been quite a night again.
It certainly has, Nick. Yes, we have to start in Germany, where eagles dare.
As the glitter and the fireworks go off, Dean Henderson lifts the trophy above his head. A night these Crystal Palace fans who were here to witness it will never, ever forget. Crystal Palace have won a European trophy.
For the very first time in their history, Crystal Palace beat Spanish side Rayo Vallecano by 1-0 last night in a nervy Europa Conference League final in Leipzig. Alistair Bruce Ball has the story of the match.
It took Crystal Palace 120 years to win their first major trophy. Now in the space of just over a year, they've won three under the shrewd stewardship of their manager, Oliver Glasner, who unexpectedly decided to let his hair down at the end and celebrate with a full-length dive, Jurgen Klinsmann style. That got nearly as big a cheer as Jean-Philippe Mateta's winning goal at the start of the second half, an instinctive finish on the rebound after Adam Wharton's shot was parried. Palace nearly took the final away from Vallecano in the next 5 minutes. Jeremy Pino hitting both posts with a free kick and Mateta denied by a brilliant save. But Palace weren't to be denied the ultimate glory. They're only the 12th English club to lay their hands on one of UEFA's major European trophies.
Let's hear then from the manager, Oliver Glasner. After his last match in charge of Crystal Palace, he announced back in January that he would be leaving the club this summer. But after making more history with the club, might the German be persuaded to stay on?
No, I see myself as a servant for the players, as a servant for the club, and then somebody who gives the direction. I got many messages from fans where they said thank you for the best day in my life and all the stuff, and I really appreciate it. And I told the players exactly the same. So I have to say thank you to the players. I have to say thank you to the supporters because they have to do all the job.
Plenty more reaction to Crystal Palace's success later in the programme. We'll be speaking to their former manager, Steve Coppell. Elsewhere in football, FIFA have been accused of artificially inflating prices and misleading fans over the sale of World Cup tickets. It comes after the Attorney Generals of both New York and New Jersey officially launched an investigation into FIFA's practices, calling the process a gauntlet of confusion, fake scarcity and impossibly high prices. Next to tennis, and Fran Jones's breakthrough at the French Open was ended yesterday. The 25-year-old Brit was beaten by the Czech 27th seed, Maria Buzkova.
I'm a little bit of a late bloomer, you know, at the end of the day. It's still my first main draw here, and maybe you could put it down to experience and how I chose to play a little bit more, yeah, tentative in that. I'd say more the 6-5 game than the 5-4 game. I thought she played well in the 5-4 game, to be fair. But yeah, probably do make it tough for the higher-ranked players.
Fran Jones' exit means Katie Bolter is the last remaining Brit in the singles at Roland Garros, and the British number 3 plays in Paris later today.
Thanks very much, Mike. Did you spend long coming up with Where Eagles Dare?
many eagle-based puns this morning. Be prepared for all of them.
We will wait as the programme rolls out. Thanks very much, Mike. And with a look ahead to the weekend here on Radio 4.
Every Sunday afternoon, test yourself with a new collection of quizzes across a wide range of subjects.
Right, let's test you then.
Starting with books.
Hello, I'm Claire Balding and welcome to Bookmarks, the brand new quiz for Britain's most passionate book lovers.
Life is too short to finish a rubbish book.
Then numbers. Join me, Max Fosh, for your Numbers Up, a brand new quiz show in which you're solving for X and constantly asking why. Plus travel, as Simon Reeve hosts the globe-trotting quiz Around the World in 80 Ways.
Ooh.
Test yourself with a new summer of quizzing on Sunday afternoon at 4:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Time now is 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
A major government-commissioned review examining the causes of youth unemployment is warning that the number of 16 to 24-year-olds not working or learning could reach 1.25 million within 5 years. The review's author, the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn, says there is a risk of a lost generation and blames a system stuck in the past. The government said it welcomed the findings and was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation. The US has shot down four Iranian drones, saying they posed a threat around the Strait of Hormuz. American forces also hit a ground control station in Iran. An official said the actions were purely defensive and intended to maintain the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. State media says Iran's Revolutionary Guards targeted a US airbase in response. Israel has carried out further strikes in and around the Lebanese city of Tyre after issuing evacuation orders for large swathes of the country's south. The Israel Defense Forces said it was targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. The boss of Britain's biggest house builder says first-time home buyers are facing conditions comparable to the period after the financial crisis. The chief executive of Barratt Redrow, David Thomas, said rising interest rates, student loan deductions and wages not keeping up with inflation were putting home ownership increasingly out of reach for young people. The government said it was helping thousands save for their first home through the Lifetime ISA. It's emerged that Birmingham City Council has paid itself nearly £500,000 in fines and daily charges over the past 5 years because some of its own vehicles break the rules of its clean air zone. After the operating costs of the zone is deducted, some of the money goes to central government, with the rest spent on transport or environmental schemes. The local authority says it is working at pace to upgrade its fleet.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. Now 25 minutes to seven. A lost generation of young people. That's what we will face as a nation if something is not done to tackle the problem of a growing number of young people not in employment, education or training. So says a landmark report published this morning. We'll be hearing from the author Alan Milburn at 8:10 this morning. Let's turn first to our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus. The idea that Britain has a neat problem has been around for a very long time, Damien. What makes this report different?
It has, absolutely, Nick. You're right. I mean, what the government says makes this different is its focus it's bringing to the issue, and that is this report today looking at the fundamental reasons for the problem, which is will be followed later in the year by another report from Alan Milburn laying out what he thinks can be done about it. Now, the government says that that's because it understands that that it can't afford a lost generation, and point to the things that they have already been doing. Now, they say that, you know, if you look at things like they've bringing in next month a youth jobs grant, £3,000 to a company if you take on someone who's 18 to 24 who's been on benefits and for 6 months or more. Scheme they have for those who've been on benefits for 18 months or more to subsidise jobs for 6 months. So they point to that and say they are already taking action and looking and trying to deal with the kind of root causes, things like the lifting the two-child benefit cap. What the Conservatives are saying is that state-funded jobs are economic madness, and point to the government's own actions. They say have contributed to the problem. So rise to the minimum wage, the increase in employment, new employment rights, and they say that those are part of the issue, and that they would reform welfare so it pays less and work pays more. Or work pays more than welfare. But the government says that the problems are deep-rooted and inherited, and it will be tackling them with these two reports.
Meantime, the government's political problems continue apace, don't they? And hints in the papers today of what might be about to come when emails from Peter Mandelson are finally released.
Yes, so this is the second big tranche of documents, they're much bigger actually than we had already, and that have been, we now understand, they have been handed to the Parliamentary Committee, the Intelligence and Security Committee, that's been looking at the redactions the government wants. Understand that those have been agreed between the committee and the government, and so are kind of due to be published. So could be in the coming week or perhaps a bit more. Now, what The Guardian is saying is that key security vetting document that laid out concerns about Lord Mandelson has been shared, and The Guardian says it points to links to some Chinese, Russian and Israeli figures. That because of the confidential nature of the process, no one will confirm that. But I think what all of this, exactly as you say, signals is that there is much more to come on this that could still be very, very uncomfortable for the government, for Keir Starmer.
Damien Grammaticos, thank you.
21 minutes to 7 and the news never stops coming out of the Middle East, both in the US-Iran conflict overnight and with continuing Israeli activity in Lebanon. Yoland Nell is our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, staying across all of it. Yoland, the ceasefire between US and Iran is still in place, but increasingly scratchy around the edges.
Definitely. And another serious escalation in the Gulf this morning. Kuwait reporting explosions, saying it was responding to missile and drone attacks without saying where they'd come from. But Iran's Revolutionary Guard saying that it had targeted a US airbase and that this was in response to an earlier attack near Bandar Abbas Airport. We understand that the US military shot down 4 Iranian attack drones and then struck a ground control center in Bandar Abbas before it could launch a 5th drone. So a US official who's remaining unnamed is saying that this is a purely defensive action. It's intended to maintain the ceasefire, but this is the second flare-up there's been this week, and it makes the ceasefire look increasingly shaky. It puts fresh questions over hopes for a peace deal and has caused a new rise in oil prices. This coming after Donald Trump appeared frustrated again when he was speaking at a cabinet meeting joined by the media yesterday. He said Iran was negotiating on fumes. He's coming under lots of criticism domestically. Israel has major concerns about the emerging deal from these talks that have been going on. It seems to put off a lot of critical issues for later negotiation, most notably how Iran would give up its stockpiles of highly enriched uranium.
Meanwhile, Israel is still pounding at Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy militia that's based in Lebanon, and has sort of essentially said an enormous part of the country should be evacuated so that it has a free hand against the militia.
Yeah, and just to connect all this together, I mean, what's happening in Lebanon is a major complication in the Iran talks, with Iran insisting that Lebanon must be covered by any ceasefire deal negotiated with the US. And despite the fact that technically you've got a ceasefire in place there as well, that there's been this intensification in fighting. And Israel's again attacked the city of Tyre on the Mediterranean coast. Another notification about attacks there early this morning, the Israeli military saying that since the start of the week, it's hit 550 targets in Lebanon as it's going after Hezbollah. That's a significant increase in the number of attacks. The ground operations by Israeli forces have expanded. They have crossed the river of the Litani River, this strategically important river in southern Lebanon. They've told residents across southern Lebanon to leave once again and said that they're attacking Hezbollah with extreme force. So there are these scenes of people fleeing from southern Lebanon, roads packed. This is, of course, the Eid al-Adha, important Muslim holiday. Hezbollah has been claiming responsibility for a number of attacks on Israeli soldiers. Another killed this morning. It's been using these exploding drones to really deadly effect. And it's saying that Israel must withdraw its troops from southern Lebanon. Israel is saying it's not going to do that until its citizens in the north of the country are safe.
Yoland, thank you very much indeed. Yoland Nell, our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem.
18 minutes to 7 now. Former workers on Channel 4's Married at First Sight programme have told BBC News that their bosses have what they describe as an unhealthy focus on whether cast members were having sex. The claims followed Panorama's investigation into allegations of rape during filming. The woman behind that investigation, our culture correspondent, the BBC's Noor Nanji, joins us in the studio. Morning to you, Noor. What have these workers been telling you?
Well, Nick, we've actually been trying to speak to crew on Married at First Sight UK for some time. But following our Panorama investigation last week, a number of them have come forward directly to us. So we spoke to 5 former workers who paint a picture of a show that has this unhealthy expectation of sex. And one of the workers who was there for several years and was on set for much of that time said that staff were making bets on which couple would sleep together first. And she said the bets weren't for money, but it was clear that it was all a joke to them. And we also heard that producers manufactured confrontation between cast members to make good TV. Now, you could say that any producer on a reality TV show might be looking for that sort of content. But I think given the very specific nature of Married at First Sight UK, you know, a format that is based around intimacy, there is inevitably going to be a higher risk of things going wrong. Now, lawyers for the production company CPL say contributors are not pressured in any way, that CPL doesn't recognise that allegation around bets. They also say CPL refutes any suggestion that it prioritises entertainment over the welfare of its contributors. And Channel 4, for its part, has, of course, commissioned that external review of contributor welfare on the show. It says that that review needs to take its course. And we should also point out that a number of former cast and crew have been more positive about their experiences on the programme. What this testimony does do, though, I think, is give some wider context around those allegations we revealed on Panorama last week and how they may have arisen in the first place.
You've alluded to this, but there are many people listening who say, well, of course, it's inherent in the format. If you're throwing people together, you ask them to go to bed together on a TV show. Yes, the programme will want them to have sex, and yes, the programme will want rows and fights because that's what makes good telly.
Well, look, Nick, we've heard a lot about that in recent days, haven't we? And, you know, whether the show's format is encouraging these unsafe situations. As you say that, you know, you have people expected to share a bed and a life straight after meeting. And critics, you know, have argued that by its very nature, that creates inherent risk. Now, CPL, the production company, says its welfare processes are gold standard. Channel 4 says it has robust welfare systems in place. But, you know, if former participants are saying that those protections fail them, then I think it does raise the questions whether any safeguarding could be enough in a programme of this kind.
Interestingly, Michael Grade, former boss of Ofcom, was on the media show yesterday suggesting that formats like this had gone too far. Nor Nanji, thank you very much indeed. Incidentally, Lord Grade also suggested that a politician could present the Today programme, and that was consistent with the way he'd interpreted the rules allowing politicians to present shows on GB News. Interesting. So Jeremy Corbyn and Nigel Farage will be along later.
Move over, Nick Robinson. It's a 6:45. If you've grown used to six impossible things happening before breakfast, well, brace yourself for number seven. Scientists from King's College London have become the first UK research team to gain access to Google's Willow computer. The excitement is that Willow is a quantum computer, or rather has a quantum processing chip, giving it the kind of processing power that supercomputers can only dream of. Dr. Eleanor Crane is assistant professor in quantum computing at King's College London. She'll be leading the team using the Willow quantum computer chip. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is this such a huge step forward for those of us that maybe don't quite grasp the intricacies of quantum computing?
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Really, what it's about is we want to improve the process for designing new materials and chemicals. So, you know, you think, well, wouldn't it be great if we could understand the details of how, for example, plants transform sunlight into energy? Or if we could have batteries with a longer lifetime, that would be really handy, or find drugs for previously incurable diseases. The thing is, these are governed by quantum mechanical effects. And these are actually too hard for classical computers, as you were saying, or even supercomputers to solve, which means that currently, each new material or chemical can take up to a year to create, and we don't even know if it's optimal. So if the computer could rely on quantum laws, which is the quantum computer and the Google Willow chip and other quantum computers in the world, then the calculation would be much more straightforward. And that's what we're doing. We're finding ways to use quantum computers to model phenomena in nature.
This is a time of fairly grave disquiet about tech and AI replacing people. Is quantum part of that story, or is it about putting other computers out of work?
Yes, well, that's an interesting question, whether AI will replace us all or not. Well, so first of all is, you know, the notion of replacing us all assumes that there's only a finite amount of things to do.
Sure.
But in science, for sure, there's actually an infinity of things to explore. So, you know, especially within quantum computing, the way that we use AI is more that it is, I can think of it as having many students working for me. And if I manage it badly, it's a huge waste of time. If I manage it well, it can really accelerate my kind of exploration of science. But quantum computing is slightly separate to that. Quantum computing is really about finding, you know, AI finds patterns in data and maybe gets you the right answer. You don't know at the end if you got the optimal solution. But quantum computing, it finds you the exact answer. And that's why it will really, really speed up discovery.
And will everyone have a quantum computer by Christmas?
Maybe not Christmas this year, but maybe next year.
I mean, seriously, will there be a spread, you know, in the same way that other computers have spread throughout the general population? Or is it not that kind of tool?
One of the things is we need to find what the right algorithms are which we can run on it. It is a computer, so in principle we can ask it any question. We just need to be able to find out how we ask it that question. Right. And so I think by 2028 or 2030, there may well be ways in which quantum computers can already solve extremely useful problems. Mm. And maybe, we can already access them over the cloud. So Google is one of about three quantum computers in the world, which can be so advanced and which is at the edge of what we can calculate with classical computers.
Eleanor, enjoy your time with Willow. Come back and tell us what you find. Thank you very much indeed. Dr. Eleanor Crane there from King's College London.
11 minutes to 7 now. Welfare bills are too high and they keep too many people out of work. It's a view increasingly heard from politicians on both left and right, but saying it proves to be much easier than actually cutting the bill and helping people into work. This morning, the Conservatives are unveiling a plan to ensure that many of those suffering mild anxiety or less severe neurodiversity are no longer paid PIP, the personal independence payment. We're joined by the woman behind the plans, the Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Helen Whateley. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What's the problem you're trying to find an answer to?
Well, too many people are being written off sick, particularly being written off for lower level mental health conditions. That's things like anxiety, mild depression and ADHD. That's actually particularly affecting young people. And this is the fastest growing area of sickness benefits. And it's the sickness benefit bill we're talking about here. But rather than writing people off and giving them cash handouts, it'd be better to be giving people support. So we have said that within 2 years of a new Conservative government, we will reassess all the claims for sickness benefits for low-level mental health conditions like this.
Are you sure reassessment will work? Because looking at the recent reassessments, most of them, 89% in the last year, actually resulted in people carrying on getting the award they'd had before.
I'll come to that in a moment, and part of it is the approach to how you do assessments. But firstly, we're saying that rather than give people cash handouts, support is much better. People are ending up on welfare and on the money rather than in work. And for these kind of low-level mental health conditions, being in work is usually better.
Yep, but yes, so that's the aim.
But there are two parts to this policy. One is the reassessment side. I mean, the other is simply that we have said, and we have already announced that we will stop giving sickness benefits for lower level mental health conditions, for anxiety, for mild depression, for neurodiversity like ADHD.
So you're saying you'll change the rules that underlie the reassessments, are you?
Because
correct. At the moment, just to repeat, most people stay on the benefit when they're reassessed.
You're correct. So firstly, we're going to change the rules and say those are no longer reasons to be receiving sickness benefits, particularly the personal independence payment, which is intended to help you with the extra costs that you may have when you have a disability, which doesn't in fact apply in the same way when, for instance, you're struggling with anxiety or indeed with ADHD. It's not the same as some of the disabilities that PIP was intended when it was invented as a benefit to support.
Understood. And you say it's better to have a job, Helen Whateley, but we know today we're focusing on the issue of NEETs, a million young people who've got no job and are not in education or training. What would you do differently to make sure there are jobs for people in that situation?
I'll come to that in one moment.
Could you come to it now? Because that's the question I'm asking.
Let me say just the other part of the assessment process is moving to having face-to-face assessments. So one of the things that's happened is a lot of assessments are now being done over the phone. That is not a good way to assess people's need for support.
Sorry to rush you along, but time is short. So what's the answer to the question?
What would we do differently on jobs? I mean, this is something I clearly spend a lot of time looking at. I'm very concerned about the situation, particularly for young people up and down the country who are unable to get a job at the moment, getting hundreds of rejections. If they're lucky, in fact, usually they get silence. The first thing we would do is take a different approach to Labour, who have killed jobs time and again with their policies. Well, for instance, I mean, let's just look at some of the things they have done.
No, let's not. Let's do what you would do there. Forgive me. Okay. We've got to do this situation in an interview. I ask a question and you at least try to answer it. What would you do?
I guess the point I was making is we wouldn't have done a load of the things that they have done.
What would you do?
Very specifically, one of the things that we would do is roll back some of the red tape that they've put in their employment rights bill. The other thing is backing businesses to create jobs. to the extent that they've tried to do something to help young people, it's been things like paid for work experience programs. What we know is what people really want is jobs. You've got to back businesses to create jobs. Their policies have killed over 300,000 jobs since they've been in government. We would back businesses to create more jobs. We've done that in the past in power. We would do that again.
Helen Whateley, Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. Thank you.
7 minutes to seven. Type 2 diabetes is generally more likely to be found amongst older people. It is surprisingly common, but it's something that most people get later in life. But there has been a sharp increase in diagnoses amongst women under 40, comfortably outstripping those given to women over 40 and well above men under 40. The concern is that pregnant women are developing what's called gestational diabetes, and then it's not being picked up in postnatal checks. Colette Marshall is Chief Executive of Diabetes UK. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a very surprising statistic about women under 40. Have I got that right, that it's a concern that gestational diabetes is morphing into type 2 diabetes because of a lack of checks?
We're really concerned that the number of women under the age of 40, the rate of increase is twice that of women over the age of 40. And the reason this is an issue is type 2 diabetes at a younger age presents much more aggressively, much more high risk of having complications such as heart attacks, strokes, chronic heart failure. Indeed, the impact on life expectancy can be quite severe. If you're diagnosed at the age of 30 with type 2 diabetes, that can lead to 13 years shorter life. So it's very serious. And we're really concerned that the recent new first-time national diabetes gestational diabetes audit is showing that women who have gestational diabetes, which is a key risk factor for type 2, are not getting the follow-on checks nor the prevention support that would stop them progressing to type 2 diabetes.
Because if they got those checks, then someone could say, right, you've got gestational diabetes, this is what you need to do, and then you'd stop them moving on to or developing into type 2 diabetes.
So if a woman has gestational diabetes, they should be checked after their birth between 6 and 13 weeks to make sure that the gestational diabetes has gone. Even if it has gone, they should then be checked every year thereafter to make sure they haven't got type 2 diabetes. They should also be offered a place that are excellent diabetes prevention programs run through the NHS. And at the moment, we're only seeing 5% of women with gestational diabetes going on those programs. So that's a really big missed opportunity.
Okay, because the Department of Health and Social Care has said that the NHS is rolling out maternal medicine networks to ensure that women with problems around pregnancy have access to specialist care, and they say they realise that these pregnancy-related disorders are associated with worse long-term health outcomes. It does sound as if they are aware of this and trying to act on it.
So central NHS may very well be aware of it, but what we're seeing in primary care across the country is really low awareness, and also among women. So we're seeing that women aren't getting the checks. Only 60% of women are getting their checks every year thereafter. And they're simply not being offered the prevention programme. So we really want to see much better data so it can be tracked and we can see improvement. The data is really pretty poor. And we then want to see that women are getting these checks and getting offered prevention.
It's worth sort of mentioning as well, it's not just about pregnant women, is it? There's also questions of specific groups, about urban deprivation, about the situation that people find themselves in their lives.
So type 2 diabetes and gestational diabetes, but type 2 diabetes is a complex range of factors. Yeah. You're more at risk if you live in an area of social deprivation, if you're from a South Asian, Black African or Middle Eastern background. If you have diabetes in your family, whether that's type 1 or type 2, that increases your risk. If you're older and if you're male, but we're particularly worried about this cohort of young women.
Colette, thank you very much indeed. Colette Marshall from the Diabetes UK charity. Thanks.
Is just the wildest story when it actually happened.
On BBC iPlayer.
Believe in Magic was like no other charity.
The sweeter the story,
they would just appear and sprinkle their magic.
The darker the truth.
It was all based on a lie.
It was unbelievable.
A mother and daughter running this charity. Was Meghan really sick?
The story doesn't add up.
The mother of all cons.
I had no idea where it would all lead.
Starts on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
It's 2 minutes to seven. Let's find out what the best weather in the world has in store for us. Stavdenaos is there.
Thanks very much, Johnny and Nick. Good morning to you. Early showers, thunderstorms are continuing to move northwards over northern and eastern England at the moment. They'll clear away next few hours. That's going to leave a dry, sunny and a warm morning for all parts. Now, as we head into the afternoon, southern England, Wales, Northern Ireland will tend to turn a little bit cloudier. I could see a few showers developing here and there, particularly southern England. And some of these could be heavy and thundery. But the far north of England, Scotland, the Midlands should stay largely dry and sunny throughout the day today. Now, it's going to be a warmer day across southern and eastern areas compared to yesterday. Temperatures generally across the UK widely reach in the mid to high 20s and perhaps at 30, 31 degrees in southeast England. A little bit fresher into Northern Ireland and western Scotland, mainly the high teens and low 20s here. And then tonight, any remaining showers will fade away during the evening, leaving a mostly dry night with clear spells, variable cloud. However, western Scotland will see increasing winds and outbreaks of showery rain arriving by the end of the night. But it will be a mild night, temperatures 10 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow, Scotland, Northern Ireland will have a cloudier day with a fresh westerly wind and patchy rain, thanks to low pressure moving in off the Atlantic. Most of the rain will be across western Scotland. Eastern Scotland should tend to stay dry and brighter with some sunny spells. England and Wales, though, sees another largely dry day with decent sunny spells, although the odd shower could develop later in the day. And again, it could be thundery. It's going to remain warm across England and Wales, highs into the mid to high 20s Celsius. Cooler conditions across Scotland, Northern Ireland, with temperatures ranging from 15 to 21 degrees. Into the weekend, it turns more unsettled, particularly in the north and the west, and temperatures continuing to come down.
Thanks to have you listening to Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 28th of May. The headlines: a review commissioned by the government is warning of a lost generation unless urgent reforms are made to get more young people into education or employment. We'll speak with the author of the review, the former Labour Health Secretary, Alan Milburn.
The story sometimes is, you know, this is a soft generation, they're a snowflake generation, they've given up trying, they're not interested in work. It is just not true.
Renewed hostilities are threatening the ceasefire between the US and Iran after both sides traded fresh attacks. The boss of Britain's biggest house builder has told the BBC that current conditions for first-time buyers are amongst the worst he's known.
Also in the programme, Tony Blair had his say yesterday on the programme. Now the men who want to be the next leader of the Labour Party, the next Prime Minister, have hit back. Wes Streeting and Andy Burnham accused the former Prime Minister of ignoring the importance of inequality. And we'll be asking whether that is fair and whether that really is the defining challenge of our age. And what's the winner of the Sound of the Year award? Past winners include sounds of polling stations and Lime bikes being stolen in London. We'll have this year's winner for you. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
The author of a government-commissioned review says there's a risk of a lost generation in the UK unless urgent action is taken to ensure more young people are either earning or learning. An interim report by the former Labour Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, says 16 to 24-year-olds are being let down by a system stuck in the past and warns that the number of those who are not in education, employment or training could increase to 1.25 million within 5 years. Our employment correspondent Zoe Conway reports.
Alan Milburn paints a bleak picture. He says young people have been failed by the state for years. Schools, the health system, the welfare state are no longer fit for purpose, he warns, and need far-reaching reform. He says there's nothing temporary about the problem of young people not earning or learning. Without urgent action, he says, one in six 16 to 24-year-olds will not be in education or the workplace in 5 years' time. Mr. Milburn dismissed the idea that young people are snowflakes. He said they were anxious, and the overwhelming majority of those not working wanted jobs. His report is expected to say there are 1.6 million fewer low and medium-skilled roles in the economy. The government said it welcomed the report and said it was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation.
The United States has carried out fresh strikes against Iran hours after President Trump warned he was not satisfied with the terms of a proposed peace deal. A US official said the actions were purely defensive and intended to maintain the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. State media says Iran's Revolutionary Guards targeted a US airbase in response but gave no further details. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
This is the second time in 3 days that the US has attacked targets in Iran. The US shot down 4 one-way attack drones it said posed a threat over the Strait of Hormuz. The military then conducted airstrikes against an Iranian ground control station that was about to fire a 5th drone. On Monday, the United States struck missile launch sites and Iranian boats it said were trying to lay mines in the strait, where thousands of commercial tanker ships are stranded as a result of the conflict. The renewed hostilities threaten the fragile ceasefire between Iran and America as the two nations continue negotiations to end the war. Yesterday, President Trump said he was not yet satisfied with the terms of a deal, warning that if he doesn't get what he wants, America will, in his words, just finish the job in Iran.
Further Israeli strikes have hit in and around the southern Lebanese city of Tyre after Israel's military issued evacuation orders for swathes of the country's south. The areas covered by the warnings account for more than one-eighth of Lebanon's territory. Our correspondent John Sudworth reports from Beirut.
Social media videos from one of Lebanon's biggest cities shows dust-covered crowds of people gathered around collapsed buildings and with the fires being fought by rescue workers illuminating the night. The tens of thousands of residents were given a warning to leave just 2 hours before the strikes began. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this week that he will smite the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in response to its use of deadly new fibre-optic drones. Iran has said any deal with America must include Lebanon, yet this conflict is escalating, with more than 3,200 killed so far, and with ground fighting as Israeli troops attempt to push out from the swathe of land they already occupy.
The boss of Britain's biggest house builder says first-time buyers are living through one of the most challenging times to purchase a home. David Thomas, the chief executive of Barratt Redrow, has been speaking to our business correspondent Sean Farrington.
David Thomas has spent 17 years at the FTSE 100 listed Barratt Redrow. He says now is one of the most difficult times he's known to get on the housing ladder, comparable only with the aftermath of the 2008 crash. Mr. Thomas said rising interest rates, student loan deductions and wages not keeping pace with inflation were putting home ownership increasingly out of reach for younger people. And he said the lack of a government-backed support scheme was compounding the problem.
Certainly it's going to be close to where we were in terms of the post the great financial crisis. Now that was probably more to do with lending, but I think it's very, very comparable for first-time buyers. And we're now facing challenges around affordability with no government support scheme in place.
A spokesperson from the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government said it was helping thousands save for their first home through the Lifetime ISA and supporting more buyers to get a mortgage.
Former workers on the Channel 4 reality show Married at First Sight UK have told BBC News that senior staff had an unhealthy focus on whether cast members were having sex. The claims follow a panorama investigation into welfare standards on the series. Here's our culture correspondent Noor Nanji.
Several of the former workers we spoke to said there was an emphasis on sex from the outset of filming a new series of Married at First Sight UK. One said crew members made bets on which couple would sleep together first, although they weren't for money. We also heard that producers manufactured confrontations between cast members. Last week, Panorama revealed two former cast members claimed they were raped by their on-screen partners, and a third alleges a non-consensual sex act took place. Their on-screen partners have denied all the allegations against them. Some former cast and crew have been more positive about their experiences on the programme. Lawyers for the production company CPL say cast members are not pressured in any way and it doesn't recognise the allegation that staff took bets on whether contestants would have sex. CPL also refutes any suggestion that it prioritises entertainment over the welfare of contributors. Channel 4 has commissioned an external review of contributor welfare on MAFS UK.
The BBC has learned that Birmingham City Council has paid itself nearly £500,000 in daily charges and fines over the past 5 years because many of its vehicles breach the rules of its own clean air zone. Alex Homer explains.
Birmingham's clean air zone came into effect in June 2021. Its aim, to reduce vehicle emissions and air pollutants. The BBC used an environmental information regulations request to learn that between then and the end of March this year, the City Council had paid £470,000 in charges and fines for non-compliant vehicles. Most of those which drew daily charges were from its waste department, despite a bin strike that's been ongoing since January 2025. After the operating costs of the zone, some of the money it generates goes to central government, while the rest must be spent on transport or environmental schemes. King's Heath Food Bank has described the situation as absolutely shocking. The council says replacing a large number of vehicles is not a simple undertaking, but it's working at pace to upgrade the rest of its fleet.
The National Trust has warned that changing weather patterns are making it more difficult to care for Britain's largest chalk hill figure. The Cerne Abbas giant, a striking white outline of a naked club-wielding man cut into a hillside in Dorset, has been maintained by the charity for more than 100 years. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
Heavier winter rains, the National Trust says, are washing away the chalk from the giant more quickly, and our warmer, wetter winters encourage the growth of plant and algae, which soften the giant's distinctive features. Hotter, drier summers bring a different problem. Slower grass growth can leave the chalk edges more exposed to erosion. All this means, instead of getting a makeover of fresh white chalk once every decade or so, the giant is now needing one after just 7 years. The latest has just begun and will take a total of 300 National Trust staff and volunteers up to 15 days. The Met Office says the UK's climate is already notably different from even just a few decades ago, with further shifts in rainfall and heat extremes expected.
Justin Rowlett reporting.
Thanks, Jane. It is 9 minutes past seven. The downing by the US of four Iranian drones overnight and what's thought to have been an assault on an Iranian ground position is a reminder of the delicacy of the situation in the US-Iran conflict. State media says Iran responded this morning by targeting a US airbase in the region. Sirens have been heard in Kuwait. The ceasefire between the two nations is, of course, pretty critical to the continuance of negotiations. Donald Trump said yesterday that he's not satisfied with the current deal on the table. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is baying for the Strait of Hormuz to be reopened so that fuel and fertiliser can begin to flow again. Kirsten Fontenrose is a former senior director for the Gulf at the US National Security Council in the first Trump administration. She's now at the Atlantic Council. Sarah Smith is, of course, our North America editor. I started by asking Sarah about what happened overnight.
It's the second time in 3 days that the American military have done something like this, whilst there is, of course, a ceasefire in place between the US and Iran. So that is threatened, clearly, by these things that have been happening, although negotiations are continuing at the same time. We heard a bit about that from Donald Trump at a cabinet meeting. He was speaking, saying that he wasn't satisfied yet with the terms of the deal, but he remains convinced, he says, that Iran needs to make a deal. And he wanted to stress that he doesn't feel under political pressure to hurry this up. He actually said he doesn't care about the midterm elections that are coming up in November, because he obviously thinks that Iran thinks they can run out the clock here, that Donald Trump has less time than they do to get to a position where the Strait of Hormuz can be reopened, because they think it's putting so much political pressure on the American president. So he was keen to say that's not the case, and that he will take as long as he needs to in order to get the deal that he wants. And the US is obviously making clear that they're not held back from striking against Iranian facilities if they think they pose some kind of threat. The US has said that it was these were self-defense moves that led them to attack these Iranian sites on both Monday and Wednesday night.
Sarah Smith, thank you very much indeed. Kirsten Fontenrose, looking at that military action on both Monday and Wednesday, do you see it as a serious threat to the ceasefire, or is it the kind of military skirmishing that just happens when you have militaries butting up against each other?
I do think the latter is what we're seeing. Both sides are trying to stay to lines they think will prevent super escalation. So the U.S. is saying we're only acting defensively. Iran is trying to get off little strikes to show that it still has bullets in its arsenal, but they're not doing barrages, for instance. So this is both sides still doing some saber rattling with, you know, a little bit of active fire, but nothing in the way of what we'd expect if they were either side were going to launch really serious strikes.
When you look at the
negotiations, that which we know about them, do you believe that there is progress being made, or do you sense that they are stuck at the moment?
It looks like they're stuck. And what is interesting is that there seem to be as many differences about how this war should end within Iran and the U.S. as there are between Iran and the U.S. You've got a regime in Tehran that is divided into multiple factions. You've got IRGC opposing any concessions or sometimes even talks with the U.S. You have the diplomats, the president, the vice president in Iran arguing in some cases that making concessions could save the regime. And here in Washington, you have the U.S. administration divided into several factions, some saying there should be no deal with Iran and that military strikes should resume. You've got others saying the blockade should be allowed to do its job with a slow, sustained squeeze that strangles the regime. Those folks are saying, hey, look, don't look for a deal soon, and everyone should just find something else to watch because the UK's blockade of Germany from 1914 to 1918 worked, but it took time. Yeah. And then you've got other factions saying, we should make a deal. We need to focus domestically. We need to pull the military out. We need to prepare for potential conflict with China in the future. So these debates that are going on either side of that negotiating table are just as intense as the talks that are going on between the two sides.
From what you say, it doesn't sound as if a deal is close.
No, it does not look like a deal is close. And it looks like both Iran and the U.S. are trying to push the other toward a quick deal, thinking that that serves their own interests. Iran fears that the U.S. will keep the blockade on and that official government revenues will drop so low that they won't be able to pay the security forces they rely on to keep the population in check. So they conduct cyber attacks and propaganda campaigns to exacerbate the domestic pressure on the U.S. president to get out of the war, to try to force him to make those concessions and make a deal. And then you've got the U.S. that's concerned that Iran believes that if they can get the blockade lifted, exploiting the damage that the closing of the strait is doing to all these international economies that are coming to Washington, begging for a deal, then they'll have that financial breathing room to stay in a bunker, pay their street enforcers, and outlast this U.S. president.
But a baseline, I guess, for at least negotiations to happen is that the ceasefire is maintained. We sort of rather take that for granted because it's been in place, if breached now and then, but it's been in place for so long. But that needs to stay if there is going to be a move towards a deal.
Yes, that does need to stay. And both sides are talking about extending it for potentially 60 more days.
Right.
Whether they would agree to do that without preconditions is where we are right now.
That was Kirsten Fontenrose. And before that, Sarah Smith, our North America editor.
It's coming up to 16 minutes past seven. What is it like to be one of those called this morning a lost generation? One of the million young people who are now without a job and are no longer in education or training. In an hour's time, we'll hear from the man who coined the phrase, the former health secretary and chair of the Social Mobility Commission, Alan Milburn, who's been travelling the country to find out why this is happening. Last week, I joined him at a workshop session run by the charity Good Work, who run employability programmes for young people, particularly from low-income families. Some have found short-term, part-time jobs, but they've been rejected from dozens of those which they hoped their degrees, yes, 15% of NEETs are graduates, would qualify them to do.
Hello.
I'm all right. Are you?
So my name is Mohammed. I'm currently unemployed. At the moment, I'm applying to various applications, attending insight days or events at like firms to basically increase my knowledge, make me more employable and just explore as well what sort of opportunities are out there.
So I'm Ash. I'm 24 and I graduated 2 years ago in psychology and criminology. I've been working in hospitality for about 4 to 5 years now.
But you got that degree.
Yeah.
You know what you want to do, but you've just not been able to get that sort of work.
When I was in the interview processes, it always came to experience, and those more experienced than me were always chosen over me.
Hi, my name's Hesna. I'm currently employed in an education agency and I'm currently a cover supervisor and an LSA in secondary schools and colleges.
How long were you looking for work?
It's been like around a year, 2 years as well. I also did university, but I also withdrew due to personal reasons and burnout.
My name is Elias. Currently, I'm working at IKEA as a store co-worker. Originally, I wanted to do software engineering. I pursued that since 2022, and then I quit like late 2025. And then I tried to pivot to cybersecurity, which didn't work out. So now I'm in a state of limbo.
Give us a sense, Ash. What's it been like? How frustrating has the last few months, years been for you?
Especially before I got into Good Work, it just felt impossible. And it just, no matter how many applications you made, it was making no progress.
Elias, is that what it was like for you?
Yeah. You're updating your CV, you're doing all of these tips that you get from managers, hirers, and then you update your CV and you just get nothing.
Mohammed?
I think, like, with certain applications, you put your heart and soul into it and you just really imagine yourself in that role and you really think that you'll be so great for this job. And then you'll get the rejection email and there's something, like, for example, will say, oh, due to high volume of candidates, so it doesn't really even show you where you could have improved on. So I think that's a key thing. And it's just, yeah, I understand there's a lot of young people like myself applying for, like, only a set few roles in the job market. So, but it's just like it makes me sort of doubt putting myself more into the applications. So I really doubt what I should put into that, what I should put into the application. Do I show more of myself? Do I put more heart and soul into it? Because it didn't get me anywhere before, so why should I?
They're moving stories, aren't they, Alan? But I suspect you've heard lots of them.
So this is a very, very common story. So the story sometimes is, you know, this is a soft generation, they're a snowflake generation, they've given up trying, they're not interested in work. It is just not true. You know, we've done some opinion polling on this. 84% of people who are not in education, employment and training want to be in a job or want to be in training for a job. And as Mohammed has just said, you know, you end up in this situation where young people are applying sometimes for dozens, sometimes for hundreds of jobs, but literally hear nothing. And it's the silence that kills.
Husna, have you had that kind of feeling of silence?
I think it's just you try and apply so many times, nothing, you don't hear anything back. Sometimes you try to email them, ask them what was wrong, what can I improve on my application, silence.
Three of you have got university degrees. Maybe you were aiming too high. Some people listening might think, maybe you, yeah, just work in a cafe. What's wrong with that? Work in a factory, work in a warehouse. Does that make you feel really frustrated if people say that?
It's not aiming too high to want to go beyond being a cafe worker if you're overqualified to be a cafe worker. And it's not fair to put yourself in so much debt with university and to not be given the opportunity afterwards to get into the workforce.
There's another thing I heard as well, which is a couple of you talked about having problems. I don't want to probe into your private life, but is that a factor that if there are problems at home, mental health problems, physical problems, that then becomes a difficulty?
I struggled with burnout. I don't mind talking about that. It was just, I was doing a law degree, a bachelor's in law, so it is very hefty. So we didn't have a lot of support at my university for people that were struggling, I think.
You're being helped now. You're here at this charity Good Work. Have there been times in recent months, last couple of years, where it just gets all a bit too much, where you just think, actually, I can't hack this anymore, it doesn't work for me?
I think the younger generation today have a lot to compete with. There's AI, there was COVID, and even if you look at current world affairs, there's so much going on that you just think, what is the point? The job market's so bad, inflation is so high, it's getting more impossible to get a job.
I agree with her. I'm putting in so much energy, but I'm not getting anything back. I'm now in a period where I've given up and I'm trying to like rest and then see what I can do, because it's just, it's really draining.
At some point, a lot of us might want to give up because we're just getting rejected. I think a lot of us actually don't have the choice to kind of stop. Maybe a little break, maybe a month, and try to regroup and think and apply again. But if there's like a void, as Alan said before, then it's going to be very, very difficult.
Husna, Elias, Ash, Mohammed, thank you very much indeed. Good luck.
Thank you.
Alan, the Alan in question, Alan Milburn, is going to join us on the programme at 8:10, not just to describe the problem, but we hope to come up with some sense of what might be done to solve it.
That was a very hard listen. I mean, that line
it's the silence that kills, coming from 22, 23-year-olds who just sent out hundreds of job applications.
It's the curious thing, Johnny, which is if you do the jobs, we do indeed, if you listen to the programmes we present, we often hear painful stories. I actually found that traumatic.
Yeah.
That sense of hope, ambition, self-belief destroyed is quite hard to live with.
Well, Sir Tony Blair told us yesterday he wants the government to stop prioritising clean energy over cheaper energy. Sean Farrington has the boss of one of the country's biggest renewable energy companies with him. Morning again, Sean.
Hi, Johnny. Yes, so the former Prime Minister suggesting the UK's net zero carbon emissions by 2050, that target, its clean power by 2030 target, should maybe be watered down, refocused. These plans, something the renewable energy company SSE have been a part of the way it approaches its business. Its financial results just out show profits of just over £2 billion over the last year, profits before tax. Martin Pibworth is the chief executive of SSE. Morning.
Good morning, Sean.
Martin, the day after we hear energy costs for millions of households going to be increasing by 13%, we've got a key business like yours in the production of the energy we use, reporting £2 billion of profit, returning more money to shareholders than the year before. I mean, should more of that be filtering down more quickly for lower prices for homes and businesses right now?
Well, I guess the key financial metric we'd be pointing to today, Sean, is the £3.6 billion we invested in the energy system. That's investing in renewables and grid infrastructure. All of that investment will help lead to lower bills in the future. That's part of a £33 billion investment plan aimed at making sure that the UK can resource itself from an energy perspective, from renewable sources, and bring energy bills down in the medium term.
Lower bills in the future. People might be wondering when. Even in your results today, you sort of mentioned that some of your UK onshore wind projects have been affected by grid connection delays. There could be concerns that your big plans may be delayed, may be over budget, more costs coming down the line and not that lower energy that many will want.
Well, actually, I would say that energy bills are lower today as a result of the investments that the UK and companies like us have made over many years. We estimate that energy bills are about 30% lower as a consequence of that. If you look at other countries around the world, Spain, which is probably further ahead in its renewable transition, its energy prices, its electricity prices are roughly half UK prices at the moment. So there's something to aspire to as a kind of investment economy. Then in terms of what we're doing right now, so what is SSE doing right at this moment? We're building out Dogger Bank. That is the world's largest offshore wind farm. Mm. That will be bringing cheap energy into the market as it starts.
Are you a bit concerned? I mean, I know Spain has a fair bit more sun than us, as warm as it's been this week. But are you concerned, you know, just seeing the Times this morning, the front page, ministers raise heat on the Prime Minister over the North Sea, Sir Tony Blair saying what he did yesterday, that the argument is going away from clean energy being the priority and people want to see cheaper energy and maybe a little less of what you're doing and a bit more of some other stuff?
No, look, I've been in the industry 30 years. There's always a debate about the right energy mix. I don't think necessarily we should be pitching one technology against another technology. What I would say is the quickest way to cheaper bills is undoubtedly harvesting the renewable resources the UK has, including the offshore wind that I was talking about, plus investing in grids to make sure we have the efficient flow of electricity around the market to where consumers need it.
Martin Pibworth, Chief Executive of SSE, thank you very much.
Sean, thank you. It's now 26 minutes past seven. Stop. Pause. Just listen. It's something we all do increasingly rarely, as more and more of us fill every moment, whether we're inside or outside, with sound pumped through headphones or AirPods. But the Sound of the Year Awards want us to celebrate sound, everyday sound, the sound of the world around us in all its forms and complexities. And the winner of that award is announced today. In fact, it's going to be announced here and now on the Today programme. We'll talk to the chair of the judges in just a second. But let's hear, first of all, two of the runners-up, starting with a sad sound, the sound of bombing in Tehran, recorded by Shaheen Paimani. Next, let's see if you can make out what this one is, an entry singled out by the judges.
That is some curious creature. It's the sound of a data centre, recorded by Muller Divyak. Well, who is the winner then? Well, the man who can tell us is Matthew Herbert, Ivor Novello Award-winning musician and producer who chairs the judges of what is called the Radiophonic Institute's Sound of the Year competition. Morning to you, Matthew.
Good morning.
We'll get to what you hope to achieve with these awards in a second, but open the gold envelope and tell us who wins this award.
Yeah, you have to imagine the sound of a drummer drumming on a snare drum and running up with a cymbal hit at the end. But we're delighted to announce that the winner of this year's Sound of the Year is Matthias Arignon with his sound, The Songs of the Bearded Seals.
That never is a seal, Matthew. That sounds like the sound of fireworks.
It's an extraordinary noise, isn't it? I think that's sort of part of the reason for the awards is to experience these extraordinary noises that we rarely hear. And Matthias went to the Arctic Sea to record that, and that's the breeding sound of the bearded seal. So it's only heard for 90 days. So even if you got to the Arctic, you'd have to be there at the right occasion. And it's a sort of extraordinary noise. It really changes, I think, how you experience the wider world around you.
Now, that's interesting, that point, because when I first was told that the bearded seal had won, I thought, well, that doesn't tell us anything about the year, and I thought that was the point of the award. But you're doing it because it's capturing something, you think, that tells us about the state of the planet, are you?
Yeah, I mean, it's always tricky to choose a winner because you end up sort of having competing stories. You know, do you choose the sound of the Iranian bombing that you had, where you had a restaurant running in the background at the same time as hearing these bombings, or the guy calming the dog saying it's okay whilst that bombing's going on, a sort of extraordinary, like, multi-layered sound like that, or something like the data center, which is a sound that we don't really hear. You know, we had another sound that I really loved, which was the sound of extraordinary insects recorded by attaching a microphone to the stem of a leaf. And these are sort of microscopic worlds that you don't normally get exposed to.
Do you fear also that we've stopped listening, as I was saying, that, you know, I'm all in favour of people listening to radio programmes and indeed podcasts at any time of the day, but is there a danger that we just don't listen to the sound around us anymore?
Well, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because we don't have ear lids, so we don't have a way of turning off the sound around us. So actually, we're exposed to all sorts of sound, often without our permission. And things like, for example, just living near a road, for example, will lower your life expectancy. And according to the Journal of Public Economics, like, violent crime rises 1.5 to 2.5% per decibel of sound raised above a healthy level. So these are real tangible impacts that have on us, you know, that are having on us. And we sort of take sound for granted, really. You know, there's no planning rules for sound, really, very few, other than don't put a nightclub there or don't put an air conditioning unit there.
The answer is we should all listen to the bearded seals. We should keep listening to the bearded seals. I wonder if we can just hear them again, because it's quite an extraordinary sound. Now, if that doesn't improve your morning, I really don't know what will. Matthew Herbert, thank you very much indeed for telling us the winner.
It's 29 minutes to 8, and Mike is here with the sports news and hopefully a new pun about Crystal Palace.
Well, Johnny, I would say a late submission for the Sound of the Year awards from Crystal Palace fans, at least, would surely be this.
Wharton brings it forward, drives it low, palmed away. Wharton. Mateta is onside, side foots it home. The Palace fans around us go absolutely wild. Mateta goes racing off to celebrate and may well have scored a goal to win Crystal Palace a European trophy.
Yes, the Eagles have landed their first ever piece of European silverware. Crystal Palace are Europa Conference League champions for 2026. They beat the Spanish side Rayo Vallecano 1-0 in the final in Leipzig last night. Well, you heard commentator Alistair Bruce Ball describe the winning goal there, and he joins us live from Germany now. Morning, Ali.
Good morning, Mike.
So another famous night for Crystal Palace, 12 months on from winning the FA Cup at Wembley. They've made more history.
They have, yeah. The Eagles soaring to new heights, if I can join in there. Not an aesthetically pleasing game in the first half, playing against Rayo Vallecano, the first major European final for both clubs. Just felt there was a little bit too much at stake for both. Everyone a bit tense. No one wanted to make the crucial mistake. But credit Palace, actually. They were the favourites for the game, and it was a really positive spell from them, sort of seizing the day at the start of the second half. You heard the goal there. They had another couple of chances a few minutes later to take the game away from Vallecano, but they were in control from that point. And actually, the Crystal Palace supporters, both sets of supporters, that is what I'm going to take away with me from Leipzig after this final, Mike. It was just an incredible, joyous, vibrant footballing occasion.
And the goal scorer, a brief word on him, as you say, the big Frenchman, Jean-Philippe Mateta. He's had quite the season, hasn't he? He might not have even been at the club had things gone differently earlier this year.
That's right, yeah. He wanted to leave in January. He was on the brink of a move to AC Milan to go and play in Italy. Failed a medical because of a knee issue. Played a big part in a disrupted January for Crystal Palace because one of their best players, Mark Gay, left for Manchester City. They were knocked out of the FA Cup as the holders by Macclesfield in one of the biggest shocks ever, and they couldn't buy a win. And at that point, you couldn't really imagine us getting to this point. But Mateta sort of reintegrated into the team, turned up on the big night for them, and he now goes to the World Cup with France. So quite a season for him, and I imagine lots of Crystal Palace fans would be absolutely delighted if he stayed at the club.
And a final word on the manager, Oliver Glasner. Strong case now, surely, for him being Crystal Palace's greatest ever manager, yet he's leaving. Talk about going out on a high.
Yes, exactly, which makes him such a difficult act to follow. One of the biggest cheers of the night last night, Mike, was his celebration. So for people who don't know him, quite a straight-laced Austrian, but with a wry sense of humour. And in the post-match celebrations, in between his two sets of Palace players who'd formed a tunnel as they were waiting to go up and get the trophy, he threw himself onto the ground at full tilt in a Jurgen Klinsmann-style dive. and the Crystal Palace fans absolutely loved that. But no, he's done an incredible job. I mean, listen, the club hadn't won a major trophy before the FA Cup final last year. So no major trophy in 120 years, and then three in the space of just over a year. That speaks for the job he's done and why he'll be such a tough act to follow.
Definitely. And speaking of Crystal Palace managers, we'll be speaking to another one, Steve Coppell, in the next hour of the programme. For now, though, Alistair Bruce Ball live in Leipzig this morning. Many thanks.
And thank you very much indeed, Mike. Returning this afternoon here on Radio 4, the series that looks at the spectacular failures of so-called wonder products.
Toast on BBC Radio 4.
It was associated with this awful product that nobody really could understand why anybody had used it.
Were you sad to see it go?
No.
I'm Sean Farrington, and I'll be examining why five amazing business ideas are no more. From a big name in mobile phones whose future wasn't so bright, to a type of toilet paper that got wiped out.
One other brand of toilet paper, its selling point was that it wouldn't give you splinters.
The new series of Toast on Thursday lunchtimes at 12:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Coming up in about 20 minutes, how do you get a grip of a deadly health emergency in the middle of a conflict? That's the challenge facing the World Health Organization, which is calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo so that health workers can contain the spread of Ebola.
That and more coming up on Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. It's now 25 minutes to 8, and Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
A major government-commissioned review examining the causes of youth unemployment is warning that the number of 16 to 24-year-olds not working or learning could reach 1.25 million within 5 years. Its author, the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn, says there's a risk of a lost generation and blames a system stuck in the past. The government said it welcomed the findings and was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation. The US has shot down four Iranian drones, saying they posed a threat around the Strait of Hormuz. American forces also hit a ground control station in the strategic port city of Bandar Abbas. An official said the actions were purely defensive and intended to maintain the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. State media says Iran's Revolutionary Guards targeted a US airbase in response. Israel has carried out further strikes in and around the Lebanese city of Tyre after issuing evacuation orders for large swathes of the country's south. The Israel Defense Forces said it was targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. The boss of Britain's biggest house builder says first-time home buyers are facing conditions comparable to the period after the financial crisis. The chief executive of Barratt Redrow, David Thomas, said rising interest rates, student loan deductions and wages not keeping up with inflation were putting home ownership increasingly out of reach for young people. The government said it was helping thousands save for their first home through the Lifetime ISA. 18,000 homes and businesses in Kent have no water or low water pressure. South East Water is blaming increased demand due to the hot weather in areas including Whitstable, Ashford and Maidstone. It's emerged that Birmingham City Council has paid itself nearly £500,000 in fines and daily charges over the past 5 years because some of its own vehicles break the rules of its clean air zone. The local authority says it's working at pace to upgrade its fleet.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. Now 23 minutes to 8 o'clock. First he criticised them, now they're criticising him. Tony Blair accused the leaders of the party he steered to 3 election victories of having no coherent worked out plan for the future. Now Andy Burnham and Wes Streeting have accused him of misunderstanding the problems that Britain faces now as against all those years ago. In particular, the challenge of inequality. This was Sir Tony on yesterday's programme, issuing his warning against a shift to the left.
My whole belief about the Labour Party, it's had 120 years of history. It's been in power really for about a quarter of that time. And the reason for that is what I always call the birth defect of the Labour Party, when you separated the liberal progressive side from the Labour side. And New Labour was an attempt to fuse those two things back together. And that's why we won successive elections. The trouble is, since then, we've moved away from that. And you do have, I think, this unrepresented centre in British politics. And I think it's basically a supply problem and not a demand problem.
Andy Burnham gave his response in an interview with The Observer. His comments are voiced up by one of our producers.
He doesn't mention inequality once. If you don't get how that's driving politics now, if you're not rooting your analysis in the fact that people are unable to live and that things that were taken for granted are no longer affordable, then you're not understanding what's going on.
And in an article for The Guardian, Wes Streeting made a similar critique. His words are voiced by another of our colleagues.
Here is the striking weakness at the heart of Tony Blair's intervention. Across thousands of words about technology, geopolitics and political strategy, the defining issue of our age is barely confronted at all. Inequality, the economic, social and democratic fracture running through modern Britain, is treated as peripheral rather than fundamental.
So, is it about the inequality, stupid? Well, I've been speaking to Paul Johnson, former director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the author of a book on the subject, and I asked him if the criticism that Tony Blair is facing, that he ignores inequality, is a fair one.
Well, only up to a point, because I think what Tony Blair is really focusing on is how to think about growth. And actually, you need to get economic growth, in my view, in order to tackle the kind of inequality that we've got at the moment. And don't forget, if you look at income inequality, if anything, it's fallen over the last 20 years, hasn't increased for quite some time. It's high, but it hasn't been growing. But what has been growing is the importance of wealth. What's been falling is social mobility. And the importance of inheritance has been rising, all because wealth has got more important relative to earnings. And earnings haven't been going up because we haven't been growing. So in my view, if you want to tackle the kinds of inequality that are important at the moment, you have to get economic growth going as well. The one requires the other.
And yet Wes Streeting, for example, in an article in The Guardian, calls inequality the defining issue of our age. You can't treat it as peripheral. You need to treat it as fundamental. In other words, it seems to me that he's saying you can't say, don't worry, if we get the growth, the rest will look after itself.
Again, inequality is a big issue. If you ask people, a lot of people think it's very important. If you look at inequality between parts of the country, people think that's really important. And in my view, actually, some aspects of inequality are a part of the defining issues of the age because we've reduced our social mobility. How you do as a young person is more dependent on your parents, on their wealth and education and so on, than it has been for generations. So I think that does make it a defining issue. But the reason, in my view, that it is a defining issue is because after 20 years of stagnation, that background, that inheritance, that wealth has become so much more important relative to what you can do yourself. So yes, we need to tackle it, but we need to tackle it as part of a program which gets economic growth going. When you don't have economic growth, everything becomes a zero-sum game. If people aren't getting better off on average, then you can only make someone else better off by making someone worse off. And that makes politics really hard. So I think if you really want to get this working, you need to tackle the two together. Neither of them is peripheral. Both of them are central.
Well, let's turn to growth then. Tony Blair, speaking on the programme yesterday, in effect said two things, didn't he? Stop doing daft things, i.e. make it more expensive for business to hire people and to grow, and then embrace AI and tech to get us growing again.
Well, I certainly agree with the first part. I've been saying that for a very long time. Governments have been doing daft things, whether it's in the housing market, whether it's in the tax system, whether it's in regulation, for longer than I can remember. And this government has certainly done its share of daft things. I mean, putting up taxes on employment is the most obvious. Messing up the housing market, as we've done for decades. And I really do think getting the housing market right is fundamental to this, because one of the issues that people face is the cost of housing, the lack of housing. One of the things that's really creating problems for young people. Now, AI, I think, is just one example, really, of getting an industrial strategy right, about getting technology right, about growth. This is about getting productivity going. Now, exactly how AI is going to play out, I don't think any of us know. It looks like it might well be transformational. It looks like it might be inequality increasing if it results in lots of job losses. And that's one of the reasons I think there's a role for government helping to provide a strategy, both in the public sector and for the industrial strategy for the private sector.
One last one, Paul, of the sort we would have asked you when you were at the Institute of Fiscal Studies, acting as a referee in an argument. The pushback from some in Labour, not least Torsten Bell, pensions minister, criticising Tony Blair yesterday, was, look, blaming welfare for our debt problem and our deficit problem is wrong, he argued. The problem is that we pay more to borrow than we used to do in the past, and as austerity is being rolled back, inevitably the state is spending more. Who's right?
Well, actually, I think I agree with Torsten Bell on that one. If you look at working age welfare spending, it really hasn't risen as a fraction of national income for a very long time. Now, we ask, if you redefine welfare, if you're including spending on the health service, spending on special educational needs and so on, yes, spending on that has gone up very significantly over time. So spending on the welfare state has clearly gone up. Spending what we often think of as welfare, working age welfare, benefits for people of the working age haven't gone up over time. It's certainly true that we're spending a lot more for the debt that we've accumulated over a long period of time, and we're spending more on a whole series of other things. We need to spend more, it seems, on defence. As I said, the health service is costing an enormous amount more. And this decade, it really is a remarkable decade in the history of this country. Our taxes and our spending are rising by an astonishing amount, by about £150 billion a year, by about 5% of national income in a decade. We've really not seen that in peacetime in many generations.
Paul Johnson, author of Inequalities, How We Got Stuck and Where We Go Next, currently Provost of Queen's College, Oxford. Thanks for joining us.
It's 7:45. One of the things you don't want to happen in the middle of a heat wave, losing your water supply, comes pretty high up. But no water or low water pressure is the experience of 18,000 homes and businesses in southeast England right now. Southeast Water is blaming increased demand due to the hot weather in areas including Whitstable, Ashford and Maidstone. Jeff Higgins is a jam maker at the Wooden Spoon in Wye. Jeff, you have not got water at your business or at your home, I understand. Can we start with business? What's happening there?
Yes, that's correct. We've been out of water since Monday lunchtime.
And, I mean, does that mean that jam production just ceases?
It does. What happens is our kettles are steam jacketed, so they need water for that, so we can't cook without them. We can use gas, but of course then we can't wash the pans, so we can't do any production. Our pasteurising tanks use water, so effectively production is stopped, but we can do, in the meantime, packing and labelling for what we've made over the last previous days.
Right, so that is what you are doing with your staff, is it?
We can do that for so long, only until the end of this week, and then that'll be it.
And what about at home, if I can ask? You've got no water there either.
Yes, so at home, no water since Monday lunchtime. We get supplied with bottled water outside our front door, and that seems to be going okay. It's actually quite interesting to see how we live with bottled water as opposed to tap water.
Sorry, Jeff, I don't want to get personal, but are you washing with bottled water?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm a bit grimy and a bit thirsty, but it's not quite true.
Right.
I've got a header tank, like most people have, and that dribbles a bit of water in it during the day.
Right.
So that allows me to have a shower, so long as there's not more than one or two per day. So that is not so bad. It's just that ablutions are more difficult. Emptying loos and that kind of thing, that's a bit more tricky.
Right. I mean, the Southeast Water has recently lost, because of the never-ending problems with the company, its chair and its chief executive. They've sort of run out of senior staff for you to blame, I presume.
Well, it's difficult to know who to blame, because on the one hand, you know, the privatised companies, so they're meant to be more efficient. On the other hand, there seems to be profit-taking, and that the shareholders tend to be foreign-owned pension funds. Our pension funds don't get involved so much in infrastructure. Yeah. So it's a very difficult to know who to blame exactly, other than really utilities all the money should be poured back into really modernising the system.
It must be incredibly frustrating for you. I mean, obviously on the personal front, not that much fun, but for your business as well.
Look, it is frustrating, but not just that. Is that our production is a bit like an empty bed in a hotel. Once you've had a day with an empty bed, you can't get it back.
Yeah.
And we can only make so many things per day. We're now in the middle of, we're just starting our Christmas production, believe it or not, and every day has an allocated amount to make, and it's very hard to make up without using overtime later on in the year.
Jeff, thank you very much for sharing your experience with us. Jeff Higgins there from the Wooden Spoon in Wye. And the company itself, Southeast Water, is blaming increased demand due to the hot weather. We have invited them to come onto the programme.
12 minutes to 8 now. Coming up before 8 o'clock, how is ongoing conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo hampering the Ebola outbreak response? We'll be hearing from the World Health Organization. Time first, though, for Thought for the Day. The speaker joining us in the Today studio this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James's Piccadilly. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning. The late rock singer Ozzy Osbourne's son Jack spoke recently about the fact that the family have worked with an AI provider to make a digital version of his father a year after his death. Digital Ozzy, an AI-generated life-sized avatar, will be able from beyond the grave to talk, laugh, answer questions from and tease whoever wants to speak with him, just as Ozzy Osbourne did when he was alive. The CEO of the AI company making this commented that the avatar is created from authenticated source material, consented and controlled by those who love him most. His choice of language is striking. Love and control, living and consent. There's a growing market, estimated at more than £100 billion worldwide, for the grief tech industry, including what are called grief bots, the AI tool that recreates the dead as a comfort for the living. Organised religion, until recent decades exercising a near monopoly on the rituals and processes around death, might reasonably be supposed to be against this. But as evidenced by Pope Leo's first encyclical released on Monday, which addresses humanity's relationship with AI, the need for public debate about the ethics and morality of the use of AI is urgent, given the speed of change in its capabilities. The starting point for the consideration of a grief bot is that the inalienable dignity of a human being, who's lived, according to Christian teaching, as someone created in the image of God, continues after death. But we know too that at the point of death, we no longer have any control over how we're spoken about, how our past actions are interpreted. We're no longer able to explain ourselves or surprise even the ones who love us best and miss us most. We are, in a curious way, at our most vulnerable to exploitation or misuse by anyone who might make money from our memory. In this way, dying is the ultimate act of trust, not only in God, but in the people we leave behind. We can ask them to promise us that they will say certain things, scatter our ashes in certain places, live a certain way themselves. But we can't make them. We have to trust them. Perhaps we begin by recognising that the messy, contradictory heartache of grief is tender territory whenever it's invaded by commercialising forces. And in the use of a grief bot, the inalienable dignity of a person is under question at precisely the time when the person who's died has no voice to contest what's being done in their name. Love and control, living and consent. The choices of individuals who have the funds to do this for the people they've lost raise fundamental questions, not just for them, but for all the rest of us in society, who inevitably will die one day too.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. The time now, 8 minutes to 8.
A catastrophic collision of disease and conflict, the World Health Organization's verdict on the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. 220 people have died so far. The concern of the WHO is that the spider's web of conflicts in the region makes isolating the sick or building trust in the authorities' response that much harder, if not impossible. The head of the WHO is expected in country today. Dr. Chikwe Ikwazu is the executive director of the WHO Health Emergencies Programme. He's currently in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Good morning.
Good morning, Johnny. Great to be on your show.
Thank you very much for sharing time at what is such an urgent time. Could we first talk about security and why it is so important to controlling and treating the outbreak?
Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, this is a tough part of the country to be in, for sure. Has been exposed to serious insecurity challenges for quite a number of years, difficult to get to. But this is not the only story about Ituri. This is also a community, a vibrant community with thriving commerce, people traveling. And this, in addition to the challenges around insecurity, is what creates this perfect set of circumstances for a virus to thrive. In addition, the healthcare system in the area has unfortunately not been sufficiently invested in over many years. We're dealing with a virus that is fairly uncommon, a strain of the Ebola virus that, you know, we've had two outbreaks in the last 20 years. So this mix of a rare virus, the insecurity in the context of poor health service, and, you know, this thriving locally energetic community really has created a perfect mix for, an outbreak that has grown in size so rapidly, and we are playing catch up at the moment.
The head of the WHO made an appeal for a ceasefire in the region. We saw clinics attacked in the 2018-2020 outbreak. Yeah. Do you have much hope that the appeal will actually generate any results?
I absolutely do. You know, Dr. Tedros has used his voice, his credibility, his leadership, which we've, the world has benefited from over the past 10 years, to really appeal to the people leading the conflict groups, thriving for whatever goals they have, to not getting into the politics of why and how, but really appealing to their conscience to drop their weapons and face the virus that we are facing. Because this virus, this Bundibugyo strain of the Ebola virus, really doesn't care about our political differences and our ideological differences. So I think it will have an effect. We will keep pushing. We're not beyond his voice. We're speaking directly to community leaders around all the affected areas. Building trust is one of the most important strategies that we have. Is the reason I'm here, is the reason Dr. Tedros is coming, and we'll keep pushing very hard. We need the space. We need the peaceful, we need the fiscal environment. We need community peace. We've seen a few isolated incidents already. Yeah. So as we work on the public health response, in parallel, we're working with all the community leaders to find a space so that we can do our work under the leadership of the health institutions in the DRC.
There's always a lag, isn't there? A time lag between testing and understanding the real span of any outbreak. And yeah. I think testing is really quite limited at the moment, isn't it? Do you have a clear idea? Are you confident of your idea of how big the outbreak is?
Yeah, Johnny, you've really hit the nail on the head. You know, in the beginning of an outbreak, we absolutely have to establish the scale of what we're dealing with. To do that requires access to labs and testing is a fairly complex set of circumstances that we need to solve for, the reagents, the lab, the people, the expertise, and we're pushing very hard on that. That's almost the entry point into the control strategy. And the strategy for every Ebola outbreak, identify the chains of transmission, identify cases, separate them from other cases in the environment, identify contacts and find cases among them. So our strategy is clear. We're setting up to do that. We have the people, the resources now to do that, and we're scaling up very quickly. Here is the conflict. If you do that too quickly and lose the community as you're doing it, you do not, if we miss the opportunity of working with them, building trust, and really allowing them to own the response, then we ultimately fail. Okay. So there's often a conflict between speed and trust. And so as we build up the lab capacity to identify cases, as we build up the clinical pathway to identify the chains of transmission, we have to be patient and work with the community. Okay. And that's a conflict. We're getting better at it every single day as we build trust. And I'm confident that with the local leadership, with the National Public Health Institute staff that we're working with, we will be able to get on top of this and start flowing, pushing the curve down.
We will leave it there. We'll leave it there. Thank you.
But we are pushing very hard.
Thank you. Dr. Chikwe Ikwazu, thank you so much for your time.
Things just swirling around my head. Am I really the product of this?
Astonishing secrets uncovered by at-home DNA tests.
Little did I know what more was to come.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and in the new series of The Gift, we'll hear more stories emerging out of the ever-expanding global DNA database.
I did know that I was different.
You had kids together.
Yeah.
Then we met.
Then we met.
The Gift. Listen on BBC Sounds.
2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather from Stav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Johnny and Nick. Good morning to you. Showers and thunderstorms, which we had overnight, are mostly clearing away now from the northeast of England. And we're looking at another dry, sunny day for most of us. However, for South Wales, central southern England, we'll see the cloud build up into the afternoon. And that could just bring the odd shower or thunderstorm here. But for most, it's staying dry and sunny, a little bit more humid today and warmer. Central Scotland seeing temperatures up to around 25 degrees, and it's warmer in the southeast of England, ranging between the mid to high 20s for many, but we could be up to 30 or 31 degrees in the London area. So another hot one in store. As we head into tonight, most of the showers and storms fade away, and it'll be mostly dry for England and Wales, but turning breezier with more cloud and outbreaks of rain across Scotland and Northern Ireland. That's the bit of the change that we'll see into tomorrow. More unsettled Scotland, Northern Ireland, more of a breeze. Western Scotland seeing the rain. England and Wales tending to stay dry with sunny spells and feeling quite warm again, but it will be cooling down as we head through the weekend with outbreaks of rain in the north and west.
Stav, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 28th of May. The headlines: a major review has found there could be a lost generation of young people in the UK with opportunities for work or education out of reach for many. We'll speak with the author of the review, the former Labour Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, and hear from young people struggling to get a foot on the career ladder.
It's not aiming too high to want to go beyond being a cafe worker if you're overqualified to be a cafe worker. And it's not fair to put yourself in so much debt with university and to not be given the opportunity afterwards to get into the workforce.
The United States and Iran have attacked each other, straining their fragile ceasefire. And Southeast Water says increased demand has caused supply issues to thousands of properties in Kent.
Also on the programme, here we go again. Resident doctors are walking out for the 16th time over pay. There is a new health secretary for England, but the same old battle. We'll hear from the BMA and from NHS England about that dispute. And Sir Paul McCartney discusses releasing new music whilst looking back on old memories. We'll hear how watching the acclaimed documentary Get Back, full of footage of Paul and the Beatles making their final album, was a healing moment.
When I saw the film, I thought, oh no, I'm not like that at all. I'm trying to make a record. I'm trying to encourage these guys to be as great as they are. It took a weight off my mind.
That's all after the BBC News. read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
The author of a government-commissioned review says there's a risk of a lost generation in the UK unless urgent action is taken to ensure more young people are either earning or learning. An interim report by the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn says 16 to 24-year-olds are being let down by a system stuck in the past and warns that the number of those who are not in education, employment or training could increase to 1.25 million within 5 years. Our employment correspondent Zoe Conway reports.
Alan Milburn paints a bleak picture. He says young people have been failed by the state for years. Schools, the health system, the welfare state are no longer fit for purpose, he warns, and need far-reaching reform. He says there's nothing temporary about the problem of young people not earning or learning. Without urgent action, he says, one in six 16 to 24-year-olds will not be in education or the workplace in 5 years' time. Mr. Milburn dismissed the idea that young people are snowflakes. He said they were anxious, and the overwhelming majority of those not working wanted jobs. His report is expected to say there are 1.6 million fewer low and medium skilled roles in the economy. The government said it welcomed the report and said it was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation.
The Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary Helen Whateley told us that Labour's policies were making it harder for young job seekers.
One of the things that we would do is roll back some of the red tape that they've put in their employment rights bill. The other thing is backing businesses to create jobs. To the extent that they've tried to do something to help young people, it's been things like paid for work experience programmes. What we know is what people really want is jobs. You've got to back businesses to create jobs. Their policies have killed over 300,000 jobs since they've been in government. We would back businesses to create more jobs. We've done that in the past in power. We would do that again.
The United States has carried out fresh strikes against Iran hours after President Trump warned that he was not satisfied with the terms of a proposed peace deal. A US official said the actions were purely defensive and intended to maintain the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran. State media says Iran's Revolutionary Guards targeted a US airbase in response, but gave no further details. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
This is the second time in 3 days that the US has attacked targets in Iran. The US shot down four one-way attack drones it said posed a threat over the Strait of Hormuz. The military then conducted airstrikes against an Iranian ground control station that was about to fire a fifth drone. On Monday, the United States struck missile launch sites and Iranian boats it said were trying to lay mines in the strait, where thousands of commercial tanker ships are stranded as a result of the conflict. The renewed hostilities threaten the fragile ceasefire between Iran and America as the two nations continue negotiations to end the war. Yesterday, President Trump said he was not yet satisfied with the terms of a deal, warning that if he doesn't get what he wants, America will, in his words, just finish the job in Iran.
Further Israeli strikes have hit in and around the southern Lebanese city of Tyre after Israel's military issued evacuation orders for swathes of the country's south. The areas covered by the warnings account for more than one-eighth of Lebanon's territory. Our correspondent John Sudworth reports from Beirut.
Social media videos from one of Lebanon's biggest cities shows dust-covered crowds of people gathered around collapsed buildings and with the fires being fought by rescue workers illuminating the night. The tens of thousands of residents were given a warning to leave just 2 hours before the strikes began. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this week that he will smite the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in response to its use of deadly new fibre-optic drones. Iran has said any deal with America must include Lebanon, yet this conflict is escalating, with more than 3,200 killed so far, and with ground fighting as Israeli troops attempt to push out from the swathe of land they already occupy.
The boss of Britain's biggest house builder says first-time buyers are living through one of the most challenging times to purchase a home. David Thomas, the chief executive of Barratt Redrow, has been speaking to our business correspondent Sean Farrington.
David Thomas has spent 17 years at the FTSE 100 listed Barratt Redrow. He says now is one of the most difficult times he's known to get on the housing ladder, comparable only with the aftermath of the 2008 crash. Mr. Thomas said rising interest rates, student loan deductions and wages not keeping pace with inflation were putting home ownership increasingly out of reach for younger people. and he said the lack of a government-backed support scheme was compounding the problem.
Certainly it's going to be close to where we were in terms of the post the great financial crisis. Now, that was probably more to do with lending, but I think it's very, very comparable for first-time buyers. And we're now facing challenges around affordability with no government support scheme in place.
A spokesperson from the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government said it was helping thousands save for their first home through the Lifetime ISA and supporting more buyers to get a mortgage.
Police in Kenya say at least 16 students at a girls' boarding school have died in a fire that ripped through their dormitory overnight. At least 74 others have been admitted to hospital with injuries. The cause of the fire at the Utamishi Girls' Academy in Nakuru County is not yet known. Former workers on the Channel 4 reality show Married at First Sight UK have told BBC News that senior staff had an unhealthy focus on whether cast members were having sex. The claims follow a panorama investigation into welfare standards on the series. Here's our culture correspondent Noor Nanji.
Several of the former workers we spoke to said there was an emphasis on sex from the outset of filming a new series of Married at First Sight UK. One said crew members made bets on which couple would sleep together first, although they weren't for money. We also heard that producers manufactured confrontations between cast members. Last week, Panorama revealed two former cast members claimed they were raped by their on-screen partners, and a third alleges a non-consensual sex act took place. Their on-screen partners have denied all the allegations against them. Some former cast and crew have been more positive about their experiences on the programme. Lawyers for the production company CPL say cast members are not pressured in any way and it doesn't recognise the allegation that staff took bets on whether contestants would have sex. CPL also refutes any suggestion that it prioritises entertainment over the welfare of contributors. Channel 4 has commissioned an external review of contributor welfare on Maths UK.
South East Water says 18,000 homes and businesses in Kent have no water or are experiencing low water pressure. The company is blaming increased demand due to the hot weather in areas including Whitstable, Ashford and Maidstone. Simon Jones reports.
South East Water had already pleaded with its customers to use supplies only for essential purposes, such as drinking, cooking and washing. But now it says water levels in some storage reservoirs have reached critical levels after demand increased by more than 100 million litres a day. It's advising people who have intermittent supplies to consider, in its words, putting some aside. Several bottled water stations have already been set up. Earlier this month, the chair and chief executive of the company announced they were standing down after tens of thousands of homes and businesses were left without water either side of Christmas. South East Water has again apologised, but is warning that supplies will continue to be intermittent for some customers until temperatures decrease and demand reduces.
Sir Paul McCartney has been telling the BBC about the childhood experiences that inspired his latest album. The Boys of Dungeon Lane, which is out tomorrow, reminisces about Sir Paul's upbringing in Liverpool and the friendships he forged with John Lennon and the rest of the Beatles. He was speaking to our music correspondent Mark Savage.
Paul McCartney's 20th solo album finds him singing with Ringo Starr about their humble origins.
And you could be forgiven if you thought that it was rough, but it was hard to us.
The musicians grew up in Liverpool as it rebuilt itself following the Second World War, and McCartney credits the Transport Act of 1947 with making the Beatles possible.
We had buses to everywhere. You think about it, that's pretty amazing. And for people who don't have that much money, I could just hop on a bus, change at Penny Lane, go up, see John.
The morning bus was where we two would meet.
The album also reflects on how hitchhiking across Europe helped the bandmates forge their friendship. Critics have already called it a late career masterpiece.
It was a good way to get to know you before we learned to twist and shout.
Mark Savage and Paul McCartney.
Jane, thank you. It's now almost 11 minutes past eight. If you present this programme, if you listen to it regularly, you'll often hear painful stories of people caught up in wars or natural disasters, of those who've suffered abuse or neglect. Yet every day a million young people are suffering a trauma which they feel is rarely talked about, which they feel society is ignoring. It's the trauma of not being able to find a job, not just to earn a living, but to find purpose, to have the dignity of work, to use the skills you were told you needed to learn at school and at university. And that trauma is made so much worse by the death of the Saturday job, the dearth of work experience, and a system that means that young people these days all too rarely get the chance to make their case to a potential employer. They're told to fill in an online form or answer some questions, and then hear nothing. It is the silence that kills, the author of today's report on the lost generation says. We'll speak to him, to Alan Milburn, in just a moment. First, though, let's hear from some of those he's trying to help on what it is they're confronting.
No matter how many applications you made, it was making no progress.
Elias, is that what it was like for you?
Yeah. You're updating your CV, you're doing all of these tips that you get from managers, hirers, and then you update your CV and you just get nothing.
Mohammed?
I think, like, with certain applications, you put your heart and soul into it and you just really imagine yourself in that role and you really think that you'll be so great for this job. And then you'll get the rejection email and there's something like, for example, will say, oh, due to high volume of candidates, so it doesn't really even show you where you could have improved on. So I think that's a key thing. And it's just, yeah, I understand there's a lot of young people like myself applying for like only a set few roles in the job market. So, but it's just like, it makes me sort of doubt putting myself more into the applications. So I really doubt what I should put into that. What I should put into the application. Do I show more of myself? Do I put more heart and soul into it? Because it didn't get me anywhere before, so why should I?
Husner, have you had that kind of feeling of silence?
I think it's just you try and apply so many times, not that you don't hear anything back. Sometimes you try to email them, ask them what was wrong, what can I improve on my application? Silence.
Today, Alan Milburn tries to end that silence. He's the former health secretary, the former chair of the Social Mobility Commission, and today publishes a report on what he's called the lost generation. He joins us on the line from Westminster. Morning to you, Mr. Milburn.
Morning, Nick.
You have heard, you have seen a great deal. What has moved you? What surprised you in the last year?
Young people, and what you describe. I mean, there is a risk here of a lost generation. You're quite right. It's the silence that kills. It dents confidence, but more importantly, it kills hope. But here's the good thing. 84% of the young people that we've surveyed who are not in education, employment and training, it's a horrible term, NEET, but it also has pretty horrible consequences for life chances. 84% of them want to be in work. They want to be in training. So there's no shortage of effort on their part. The shortage is of opportunity and of support, and it's that that we've got to change.
I want to talk about how you do that in a second, but before we do, is this problem worse here than it is in other countries, and if so, why?
Yes, it is, and it's getting worse. So our NEET rate is three times that of Holland. It's twice that of Ireland. We've moved down the international league table over recent times. Other countries have moved up. The reason is, we've got a chronic problem here. It's getting worse, not better. We haven't got a system or a plan to deal with it. Young people today are caught in a perfect storm. If you think about what's happening in the labour market, those voices from young people that you've just heard, that first rung on the career ladder, it's just further out of reach for young people. The number of jobs in low and medium skilled type of occupations have declined by well over a million over the last 20 years. Apprenticeship starts are down by about a third in 10 years. The Saturday job has disappeared. So they're left in this void. You've got a problem in the labour market, but you've also got a problem, critically, in the system that is supposed to take young people from the world of education into the world of employment. That system is dealing with yesterday's problem, which was cyclical youth unemployment. Today, it's youth detachment. 6 in 10 of these young people have never, ever had a job. It was 4 in 10 20 years ago. It's all moving in the wrong direction. People always talk about welfare and the right to do so, but this is a problem in the labour market, in the welfare system, in the school system, in the skills system, and in the health system. And therefore, what you need is a radical, it's not reforms that you need, it's a radical reset.
Well, let's talk about what that might involve and take you through some of the possibilities. I'm going to play to you a clip you may not have heard on the Today programme last week. The country manager of Amazon UK, John Bumfrey,
yeah,
joins us, and he called for mandatory work experience for the over 16s.
I think too often you read about young people that somehow they lack motivation, they lack resilience, they lack the will to develop skills. That is not our experience. We have to stop blaming young people. It's not a motivation problem, it's a system problem, and that requires a system response.
So he's echoing what you say, but do you echo what he recommends, mandatory work experience?
Well, we're going to come up with our recommendations in the autumn. You know that this is the first report that we're publishing today, which is really trying to understand what on earth is going on here, why you've got all these young people, what's driving it, and where it will go if we do nothing. The second report will come up with recommendations, but I spoke to John a few months ago about precisely this, and Amazon do great work in this regard. They've got a brilliant program, for example, with young people with autism, you know, a special program to get them into work, and they love those workers. And what that shows, I think, is that just because you've got a disability or a health condition doesn't mean that you can't work, but you need the right level of support. That starts in the workplace, but it starts earlier in schools. Too often in our country, work experience is an afterthought. You know, for perfectly good reasons, schools are focused on qualifications, and qualifications are necessary to get young people into the labour market. They're a big protective factor against being neat. But when you talk to an employer like John, or just a few days ago, we were talking to Marks and Spencers, to John Lewis, to all of these employers, and the biggest complaint that people have is about work readiness. So they know that the young people have got qualifications. What they worry more about is whether schools have gifted them the attributes that are needed for the workplace. And that is all about communication, collaboration, agility, adaptability skills. So we do badly internationally when it comes to work experience. We've got to change it.
So that's one thing on the agenda for a possible report. Listen to one more clip. The boss of Next, Simon Wolfson, talked about there being a dramatic fall in the number of entry-level job opportunities here.
Youth unemployment is really a symptom of wider problem with employment in the economy. And of course, if you've got fewer jobs, the people who suffer most are the people with the least experience, and that is the youngest.
Now, he would say, and let's be open about this, he's a Conservative peer, that business has been loaded with costs. The costs of taking young people on have increased because the minimum wage has gone up and there is a tax on jobs, national insurance. Is that something you are prepared to say to government, think again about?
Yes, I am. And what Lord Wolfson says from Next, forget about the politics, he's an employer. Every employer that I talk to, they will say the same thing. You know, and there's no doubt that the changes that were made a couple of years ago have had an impact on employers. Because remember, every time an employer takes on a young person, it's a risk. It's a risk because the young person is improving. It's not like taking on an older worker with a CV and a track record. So the job of public policy is to minimise the risks, maximise the incentives. But no one should pretend that the decline in the entry-level job began 2 years ago. This began decades ago. It's been going on for years and years. There are 1.6 million fewer entry-level jobs now in the economy, low and medium-skilled jobs, than there were at the beginning of the century.
So the tax changes have made it worse, but they're not caused the problem.
It's a long-term structural problem, and young people are very much on the front line of that problem.
Let's turn to the benefit system that you alluded to a second ago. You have talked about the vast amount that is spent on paying people not to work and the relatively small amount that is spent on getting them into work. Is that, as you look towards your recommendations for the autumn, about a system that makes benefit more conditional? You know, get money for unlimited periods or unless you do certain things? Or is it about changing the system from a payment system to a job training experience and a preparation system?
Well, look, the easiest thing in the world is to come on the radio and say what we need to do is cut the benefits bill. I think we should be paying out less in the benefits bill overall, but the way to do that is not by some arbitrary cut. The way to do it is to get young people into work, because if they're in work, they're earning a wage, they're paying their taxes, and they become less reliant on benefits over time. That's what we need to do. That's not how the benefit system is currently set up. For every £25 that we pay out in benefits to young people, currently we're only paying £1 out in employment support to get them into work, even though we know that 50% of the young people who are getting a health or a disability benefit say that they want to be in work and need the support to do so. Look, the benefit system's got to serve a whole variety of different purposes, hasn't it? For people with severe and enduring disability, of course the benefit system has just got to be there for them. They can't earn income. The state has got to give them it. But for young people who've never been in work, the benefit system can't just be a safety net. It's got to be a springboard. It's got to provide more opportunities for people to get work experience, to get a first taste of a job, to be counselled, to be helped, to be supported into work. That's what young people want. That's not what the system is doing, and that's why it needs to
this
change.
This is a mighty big agenda. You've been in government. You're in Tony Blair's cabinet, of course, as health secretary. Is this government ready to reset to the extent that you think it needs to do? And where's the evidence for that?
Yes, I hope so. Look, the sponsoring minister for this is Pat McFadden, the Work and Pension Secretary. Pat is absolutely up for this. He wants to make these reforms, and they need to make these reforms.
But should they listen to Tony Blair, your old boss?
Well, Tony's always worth listening to, isn't he? He's certainly capable
of... Some of them don't seem to think so. They think he's living in another era.
Yes, I hear that. He's certainly capable of making an argument and, in this case, creating one, isn't he? So he's still pretty good at that. He's always worth listening to, and he's right to say that in politics, you need a plan and you need an agenda. What he didn't say is that politics also needs a cause. There aren't many causes in modern British politics. This should be the cause. The plight of the next generation, the possibility, the risk of a lost generation is too big for politics across the piece. Whether it's Labour, Tory reform, I'm not really bothered. Honestly, what we can't do is put a whole generation at risk. And that means a whole system effort, not just to reform welfare. Becoming neat doesn't start at the age of 16. You know, if a kid goes to school not school ready at the age of 4 or 5, they're 3 times more likely to be neat at the age of 16 and 17. So we've got to change schools, we've got to change skills, we've got to change the welfare system, we've got to change the health system. And if we do that, then, like other countries, we can have far lower neat rates. There's no reason on earth why the neat rate is 3 times lower in Holland and half the rate in Ireland from here, other than they're doing something different.
There's the agenda. We just need to see which leader's going to implement it. I suggested to Tony Blair he might like to come back. Maybe you'll come back with him, Alan.
Thank you. Once bitten, twice shy.
I think that's a no.
Alan Melford, thanks. Look forward to the recommendations later in the year.
It's 23 minutes past 8, 24 minutes past 8, in fact. And just to mention, Pat McFadden will be on the PM programme about 5:30 here on Radio 4, perhaps picking up on some of those themes that Alan Milburn has mentioned. The new Health Secretary has received the now traditional welcome from resident doctors, once known as junior doctors, the announcement of a 4-day strike in mid-June. James Murray met the BMA, the Doctors' Trade Union, on Wednesday. The strike was announced the next day. His reaction: the pay increase that the BMA wants is unrealistic, unaffordable and unsustainable. Caught between the rock and the hard place is the NHS and the patients that it should be treating. The resident doctors are pushing for a lot more pay to make up for the way it's fallen behind over the past couple of decades, and a lot more jobs for their members to progress to. The government says the money's not there and the strikes make it even more difficult to find the cash and jobs the doctors want. Dr. Chris Streeter is the Regional Medical Director of NHS London. Emma Runswick is the Deputy Chair of the BMA. Good morning to both of you. Chris Streeter, can I start with you?
Good morning.
Can I start with you? The impact of these strikes, we have had so many of them now. Presumably the NHS is rather learning to cope with them.
Yeah, I'm sad about the situation, and you're correct that we have learned to cope. So other staff, consultant staff, resident doctors that aren't taking action, physios and radiographers and nurses and other clinical healthcare professionals just go the extra mile and fill in the gaps. And we're very practiced at keeping things safe in emergency care, and we've become very practiced at maintaining planned care. We do, you know, around 95% of planned care, planned operations and planned investigations during industrial action. But it's not without a cost. It costs money to pay the staff to fill shifts, but it also erodes erodes goodwill amongst other staff, towards the NHS in general and towards resident doctors.
Emma Runswick, you have been calling these strikes now for years. Do you feel you're making any progress in negotiations with the officials that you talk to?
Yeah, over the last several years, we've made lots of progress from a position where previous Conservative governments said that we would never move at all on pay or on jobs, to a position where we've had a start to our journey of pay restoration. We've had an admission from this government that we need more jobs for resident doctors so that we can give the care that patients deserve, and we've made lots of progress actually with the previous Health Secretary, Mr. Streeting. What's a shame is that journey has not continued, and we still have no further detail on what jobs will be provided. The 1,000 jobs proposed have no detail, and therefore we have no confidence that they will ever emerge, and that despite having loads of progress with Department of Health officials, and in our opinion being quite close to a deal, James Murray has not taken the chance to succeed in making further progress, but has instead returned to an offer that was put to us in March and rejected, and chosen to put us in a position where we are striking again. And accruing those costs that Dr. Streeter is talking about in money, rather than settling the dispute and enabling us to all make the continued progress in the NHS we want to see.
When you talk about a start to a journey of pay restoration, the government says you have had a 33.4% pay rise over 4 years, which is quite a considerable start. And many people look at your claim and the attempt to get pay restoration and say, well, look, those were different times. And frankly, the government was a lot flusher back in, 2012, 2013, when you start your look back at pay. What do you say to them when they look at those numbers?
It seems like a big number because of the extreme level of real terms pay erosion that doctors had faced and the extreme levels of inflation that we have faced over the last several years. We are still in a position where fully qualified doctors are paid less than £20 an hour, treating your children, being the first person to see you overnight in the hospital, looking after the sickest patients, are paid £19.27 an hour. If they had been paid in line with inflation, they would be paid £23 an hour. We are still down, despite all of those pay increases, those discussions, we're still down a fifth compared to people who were doing those same jobs in 2008. Okay. And even that money doesn't solve the jobs crisis that we are in. The absolute chaos in workforce planning has created a situation where 40,000 doctors this year have applied for approximately 11,000 jobs, leaving many of them facing unemployment. I've got colleagues, including recent parents, who are about to be thrown into the scrap heap of gig economy work because we do not provide the jobs for all of the medical students that we have trained in this country.
I want to get a last word from Dr. Streeter, if I could. Can I just get a last word from Dr. Streeter? Dr. Streeter, can you give me a sense of how much support you think there is now amongst your colleagues for resident doctors and their cause?
I think it's a sort of game of two halves, really. There are two things. There's a lot of support for improving career prospects, for career progression, and improving the general conditions that they work in, providing more involvement in continuity of care and working better in teams. And we really need to do a serious job about reforming postgraduate medical training. And there's some urgency to get on with that. Mm-hmm. There's very little sympathy about the pay issue. Although maybe resident doctors haven't caught up completely, they've done much better than other public sector workers. And if you're a nurse or a physiotherapist or a healthcare assistant, you look with envy on the pay rises that resident doctors have got recently.
We'll leave it there. I'm sorry, I wish we had more time. Dr. Chris Streeter, Emma Runswick, no doubt we will return to this, but for the moment, thank you.
Coming up in the next half hour, the boss of Britain's biggest house builder has told this programme that current conditions for first-time buyers are amongst the worst he's known. what's going on with housing. We'll come to that soon. First, though, Mike, with some more cheery sports news.
Absolutely, yes, Nick. Another week, another English club celebrating winning a major European trophy. This time last week, you might remember, it was all about Aston Villa winning the Europa League. This morning...
It's another trophy for Crystal Palace. A year ago, it was the FA Cup final at Wembley. And then a year later, they celebrate again. The Community Shield has come in between that as well. 120 years without a trophy. And now they've got three in the cabinet. What is it they say about those London buses?
Yes, what a night for Crystal Palace. They beat the Spanish side Rayo Vallecano 1-0 to win the Europa Conference League, a first ever European trophy in their 121-year history. Well, delighted to say we can reflect on that achievement now with the former Crystal Palace manager, Steve Coppell, who joins us on the programme. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So, Palace, a club I know that has a special place in your heart. How was it for you watching those scenes of jubilation in Leipzig last night?
Well, just so pleased for everybody at the club, really. People from South London, Crystal Palace fans everywhere. It's been a journey with Oliver Glasner in charge. He's been a magnificent manager. He's really upped the game of the club. But a reflection on last night, superb. Not a great game, but I think Palace with a better side. You can see their determination to do something which the club has never done before, as you said. Success in Europe has been a dream for so many Palace fans. South London is a very happy place this morning.
And it just goes to show, doesn't it, Steve, that this wasn't a particularly brilliant season for Palace in the Premier League. They finished 15th, only 6 points above the relegation zone. But I guess last night and 12 months ago at Wembley just shows, doesn't it, that for many fans, it's winning trophies and silverware that really matters.
Oh, for sure. That is what football is all about. That's what you work so hard for. You look at the players that Palace have lost in the last year or so, you know, Alisse, Eze, Mark Gay this year, you know, to overcome those top quality player losses and to be successful, I think you can only compliment the players. And remember, these players, it's not a great rotation within the Palace squad, and they played 60 games this year. And yet the manager has inspired them to, you know, fabulous success on the field. He's given them a belief that they are capable of beating anybody. And the FA Cup success, the Community Shield, and last night just proved that he was right. And yet, you know, chances are there'll be a few of them missing when next season starts. And the big man himself, Oliver Glasner, has said that he won't be there. But I think Stephen Parrish, the Palace chairman, should do his very best to make him try and change his mind or even to consider changing his mind.
Do you think that's likely? As you say, Glasner said months ago, back in January, that he would be leaving this summer. I mean, there's some people who might say go out on a high. It perhaps might never get any better than this for Crystal Palace. But do you think that Steve Parrish and the rest of the management team will be doing their best to try and persuade the Austrian Oliver Glasner to stay on?
I think they'll be doing the best, but I think Oliver Glasner has made his mind up. You know, he wants to a fresh challenge somewhere else. You know, what he's done at Palace is just incredible. I've always felt that Europe sort of owed Palace something, because when I was manager, we finished third in the top division and we were denied qualification into Europe. So, you know, for me particularly, I must admit, seeing the team be successful in the European stage last night was particularly sweet. And I can only congratulate everybody at the club for what they've achieved this year. It's been, you know, demanding, and they'll all deserve a big rest before they start again next year, whoever's in charge.
Well, the celebrations in South London, I'm sure, have only just begun. Steve Coppell, many thanks for speaking to us on the programme this morning.
Thank you.
The big question, Johnny and Nick, now is, after success for Palace and for Villa, can Arsenal complete the hat-trick of English success in Europe in the big one, the Champions League final this Saturday against Paris Saint-Germain, the defending champions? We've never had three English clubs in three European finals before. We're two-thirds of the way there. Let's see what happens.
Naturally, I wish them well, Mike. But, you may be interested to know that I should be leaving the country in order to avoid this, in order to go on holiday. Incidentally, Stevie Coppell, you forgot to mention, played for Manchester United on the wing while studying for a degree in economics.
Which was a bit of a rarity.
They breed them smart at Old Trafford, don't they?
Renaissance man. Let's hear from Misha Glennie about this morning's In Our Time.
Good morning.
From the Hay Festival, we'll be discussing the Welsh Marches, the militarised borderlands created by and for Norman warlords after the 1066 conquest. For over 400 years, these lords ran their marches almost independent of the kings in London, with one law for the English and another for the Welsh. In return for autonomy, they protected England from invasion and could use their bases to invade Ireland. And they built hundreds and hundreds of castles. That's the Welsh Marches with Helen Fulton, Hireen Emlyn and Hugh Price on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock.
Time now. Thank you, Misha. 4 minutes to 9 o'clock. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
A government-commissioned review is warning the number of 16 to 24-year-olds not in work or training could reach 1.25 million within 5 years. Its author, the former Labour Health Secretary Alan Milburn, told us there was no system or plan to fix youth unemployment, and despite young people's efforts to find work, they were facing a perfect storm. He said a radical reset was needed. The government said it welcomed the findings and was carrying out the biggest youth employment reforms in a generation. The United States has carried out fresh strikes against Iran. American forces targeted an Iranian ground control station, which it said was launching drones. Iran says it responded by attacking a US base. There have been more Israeli strikes in and around the Lebanese city of Tyre. The Israel Defense Forces said it was targeting Hezbollah infrastructure. 18,000 homes and businesses in Kent have no water or low water pressure. South East Water is blaming increased demand due to the hot weather in areas including Whitstable, Ashford and Maidstone.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 22 minutes to nine now. A home of your own. For many years, for many people, that has been the British dream, but it's an increasingly unaffordable one. Those who build houses say that first-time home buyers are facing some of the most challenging times they've ever seen. David Thomas has worked for the biggest house builders, Barratt Redrow, for more than 17 years. He's now the chief executive, and he's been speaking in the Big Boss interview to our man, Sean.
Affordability has deteriorated. I mean, there's been slight improvements as interest rates have fallen, but then we've obviously seen recent rises in interest rates. I think the other area that for younger people, which proves challenging, is where people are carrying student debt. So that is another factor to feed into the affordability equation in terms of deductions that are already coming from salaries. You know, we've said that we do believe that the government should put in place some demand package, particularly focused for first-time buyers.
Put in place some demand package, some sort of help for first-time buyers. Well, let's discuss the options with Hannah Aldridge, who's a senior analyst specialising in housing at the Resolution Foundation, and with Gavin Barwell, Lord Barwell, former Conservative housing minister, who both join me. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Let's begin with the background first, Hannah, if we could. He describes the problems. What do you see at the Resolution Foundation?
Yeah, so we recently completed some research looking at the opportunities that potential first-time buyers have. And what we found is actually income isn't really the main constraint that they're facing. It's the deposit that's holding them back. So ultimately, that bottom rung of the housing ladder is broken for many who don't have access to the bank of mum and dad who can build up a deposit. So about half of potential first-time buyers can get on the housing ladder based on their income. The problem is they don't have enough saved for just a modest 5% deposit on a starter home.
And that is why people in the housing industry, like we've just heard, want some sort of government help, a top-up in effect.
Yeah, and I can understand why they'd be calling it. And Help to Buy is a very appealing programme for developers because it essentially tells developers, if you build the homes, then we'll make sure that there are people there to buy them at the price that you're selling them at. But I think one thing that we need to be concerned about in terms of returning to Help to Buy is actually Help to Buy didn't necessarily help people move into home ownership. It helped people who would otherwise have bought a home, buy a bigger home and perhaps have lower repayments. But ultimately, many of the people that it helped would have been able to buy anyway. So I'd like to see a programme that focuses more on those who don't have the savings in the first place.
And you would do that how?
So we've proposed a starter deposit scheme, which essentially goes towards people who could get a mortgage from their high street bank. The problem is that they don't have the savings for it, and that's because they're already paying quite a high price in their rent. So essentially really focusing on this target group of people who are locked out of the system.
Gavin Barwell, Lord Barwell, do you think it's sensible for government, when it's so hard pressed, to spend money subsidising people to buy a home?
So I have quite a lot of sympathy with what Hannah's just said. I don't think, Nick, the main answer to the housing crisis is on the demand side. I think the basic problem is we haven't built enough homes in this country for nearly 40 or 50 years. But I do think there are two particular blockers at the moment. So the government's actually done quite a lot of good things on planning reform, on loosening up the planning system, but it's not seeing the benefit of those changes, partly for the reasons David and Hannah have outlined, which is there's just not enough demand, which is partly about first-time buyers' ability to access a mortgage. It's also about a general lack of consumer confidence at the moment, given the state of the global kind of macroeconomic environment. And then I think you've also got a viability issue that many developers are facing, in that if you look at what's happened over the last 5 years or so, they've seen significant increases in the cost of building a home, both because of the inflation that we've all been experiencing and because of the policy cost that the government have added, that house prices haven't really gone up. So for lots of schemes, they just can't make any money on building them at the moment, and the schemes are stuck, essentially. So I think the two things that you need to get things going are a much better targeted demand-side intervention than Help to Buy, and then the government needs to look at some of the policy costs it's imposing and try and tackle the viability issue you've got in a lot of schemes at the moment.
Some people listening might think, why help people to buy, Lord Barwell? After all, many young people in countries just across the channel never buy a home or a flat or an apartment. They rent for their whole lives. And it is sometimes argued that home ownership in this country is wonderful if you're part of that revolution, if you like, but pretty rough if you're not, because some people have a lot of assets and other people don't. Why not just say, let's transform our housing economy and have more people rent?
So I'd answer that in two ways, Nick. I think, first of all, we are just culturally different in this country. Most people want to own their own home, and I think politicians should be trying to help them to achieve that. It's a pretty depressing thought if the vast majority of people in my generation have the opportunity to do that, and we're just going to say, well, we're going to give up on that and not let the next generation have those opportunities. But more generally, if you're concerned about, as I am, about inequality and wealth in our society, if you have a country where some people, with the help of mum and dad or grandparents, can own a home, but other people are shut out, and you have house price inflation, then what you see is a massively widening gap in wealth between the haves and the have-nots. And that's something that I think, you know, that's what we've seen really happen in this country over the last 15, 20 years. And we really need to address that, I think. So we absolutely should also make sure we've got good rental accommodation, but we should also be helping people do what they're wanting to do.
Good. That's clear. Gavin Barwell, former Conservative Housing Minister, Hannah Aldridge of the Resolution Foundation. Thanks.
It's 16 minutes to nine. It's also 70 years since Paul McCartney wrote his first song, I Lost My Little Girl. He wrote it in his childhood home in Liverpool. He went on, of course, to forge a partnership with John Lennon that changed the course of rock and roll forever. Now his 20th solo album, The Boys of Dungeon Lane, is getting rave reviews. And the star is looking back at those formative years and the people who shaped his songwriting. Ahead of its release tomorrow, he spoke to our music correspondent, Mark Savage.
One of my recent tricks is to find any weird chord that I don't even know what it is. So anyway, I just went.
Paul McCartney's on the sofa in his office in Soho, showing me how he started writing the first song of his new album.
I changed the top note, that note, put it there. And I made a kind of more reasonable chord, and then, so we had a three chord sequence. And so that started the whole thing. But I got lucky, because I don't know what that chord is.
As he plays the guitar, I notice his phone face down on the table in front of us. And on the case is a colourful photograph from a family holiday.
Together forever.
Is that the family?
Yeah, that's my grandkids.
Oh, nice.
Take a look. Four of Stella's and four of Mary's. And they're all very bright. Yale, Brown, NYU and Yale.
And do you spoil them? Are you an indulgent granddad?
Yep.
Yeah.
We talked about guitars and rock and roll.
Family and friends are the central themes of McCartney's new album.
It was a good way to get to know you.
Going right back to his childhood in post-war Liverpool.
I think because the war had ended, all my uncles and aunties and my parents were so relieved. It was piano, it was music, it was jokes. I mean, one thing just comes to mind now. One of them sort of saying to the other, do you have a pension with your job? Have you got a pension? Oh, yeah. Well, that was like something very special.
And brand new, I imagine.
Probably.
Do you have a pension?
I managed to scrape one together now.
There's a great oral tradition in your family. Your dad told a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. And I've heard you say he had a very colourful turn of phrase. Do you think that has influenced your lyrics?
Yeah, I think so. He loved words. He loved to do crosswords. And he would be very keen for me to know certain words that you wouldn't otherwise have known. So I was the only kid in the class who could spell phlegm. Let's carry on making
ripples in a pond. We'll see how far it goes. McCartney has spent the last few years going through his archives with a documentary about his 1970s band Wings and Peter Jackson's Disney Plus series Get Back, which re-evaluated the recording of the Beatles' final album.
The best bit of us always has been and always will be is when we're backs against the wall.
All we've got is us.
It was great to go back to that because I had a strange view of the period because it was business hell and I was blamed for a lot of things. I was blamed for the breakup of the Beatles and I had to sort of shoulder all of that stuff even though I knew it wasn't true. But when I saw the film, I thought, oh no, I'm not like that at all. I'm trying to make a record. I'm trying to encourage these guys to be as great as they are. Took a weight off my mind.
Well, isn't it funny, though, how the press coverage changed your own memories of the events?
Yeah. It changed my attitude to me. I thought, OK, I'm overbearing. Yeah, I can be like that. That sort of stuff does affect you, I think. The call of the train whistle
cutting through the night. I still remember that sound. The Beatles story will soon be told in a new four-part film with the actor Paul Mescal playing Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
So what tips have you given him to recreate the Paul McCartney voice?
None. No, the thing about Paul, he's got to learn guitar left-handed, which he isn't. He's right-handed. Poor guy. So I pick up this guitar and I think I'll do Blackbird. And
a nice, easy one to start with.
Yeah, you know, I was going to teach him it, I thought, you know. He plays along exactly. I think he knew it better than I did. You were only waiting for this moment to
arise. You don't really need telling that that was Paul McCartney, do you? Talking to Mark Savage. Later this morning on Radio 4, Woman's Hour looks at the growing role of women in Ukraine's war effort. That's Woman's Hour later this morning at 10.
It is 11 minutes to 9. A horror thriller about the psychological impact of war may sound like stern stuff, but Under the Shadow, which started life as an Iranian film, won glowing reviews and a BAFTA, has now been turned into what sounds like a fabulous stage production, which will open here in London in a few days' time. The film and the play tell the story of a mother and daughter sheltering from missile attack during the last year of the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. Feminist fable, fractured family drama and full-on fright fest is a slice of Mark Kermode's original film review. Babak Anvari is the writer and director of the original 2016 film, and Carmen Nasser is the author of the play based on the film. They both grace us with their presence here in the studio. Good morning to you. Babak, let me start with you about the film, if I may. What was it you wanted to try and capture in the film?
Capture all the trauma anxieties that I have from that time, because basically I was like more or less the same age as the child in the film and now in the play. So, you know, that just like tapping into that, all my fears and anxieties, I felt like that would make a great horror film against that backdrop, which is also can be very universal because it's about a mother and a child really at the heart of it.
And Carmen, this is it sort of feels quite geographically limited. It's about the story of being in this house, which feels like a no-brainer for a play, but you've also got the challenge of horror, which is rarely on stage, is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, horror is having a bit of a renaissance on stage at the moment. Right. So actually, it's quite kind of timely. I think it's really interesting. If you walk into a cinema and it's empty, you're probably like, oh, this is nice. If you go into a theatre and it's empty, you're like, oh, I don't want to watch a show alone. There's something about watching something really communally about theatre that works. And I think horror, you share that with horror films as well. So I think there's something about horror that lends itself to communal watching of theatre and having sort of the democracy of horror, I guess, that everyone feels fear at the same time that really works.
Well, I love the phrase, the democracy of horror. You two have been chatting away quite happily in while you've been waiting to do this interview. How much did you work together on adapting the film for the play, or did you sort of just hand it over, Babak, and say, right, that's your job now?
Well, I did hand it over because Carmen is a brilliant writer. But we were talking a lot,
Yeah, Babak's been an amazing collaborator. I feel really blessed, actually, to have someone who has been involved, but has also given me my space and boundaries. But when I first kind of wrote the first draft, Babak read it and we continued. So he read every single draft and we'd have a conversation. But what started to happen was Babak started to give me more material, which was really brilliant. So he started to sort of talk a lot about that period in the 80s and his experience of it, and so, which was a real gift for me because I was able to sort of collect more stuff and add more detail, because I think the biggest difference between a film and a play is that there's much more dialogue in a play, so you have to expand certain scenes and sort of find material, whereas with a novel you're sort of making it smaller sometimes. So it was really helpful and a really great working relationship.
You Babak didn't have any sense of sort of loss of ownership?
No, not at all. If anything, it's just feels like it has found a new life and a new voice, and it's like when I went to watch the rehearsals, it was like a pinch yourself type of moment. I was like, I can't believe these characters that were in my head now have their own lives and now in brilliant hands. And it's very exciting for me. And the great thing about the play is that it also has more time to flesh out the characters and the dynamics, where in the film the producers are always like, truncate it, streamline it. So that's another advantage of the play,
You must have ruminated. I mean, you're British-Lebanese, British-Iranian. You must have ruminated on the violence running through the region. And writing about that and visualizing that and putting characters into that space and what it means. Did it affect you?
I started writing this play in 2022 and the film is 10 years old. So, the current climate has obviously sort of brought things sharply into focus. But the resonance of this and the meaning of it to us has kind of been just as urgent then as it is now.
Yeah.
So things have changed, but also the urgency has remained sort of just as strong as it was when I sat down to write the first draft. Because unfortunately, in the region, these issues and these themes have always been sort of present. I think our brilliant director, Nadia Latif, said something on the first day, because obviously the cast is also from various countries in the region. But there's something about creating a play or any piece of art which is inherently a hopeful act, because it's an act of creation and not one of destruction. So in the face of destruction, creating is extremely hopeful. So the room has been quite joyful. There's something about channeling a lot of these feelings into creation, which is really remarkable.
We will leave on that incredibly positive thought. Thank you very much indeed, Babak Anvari, Carmen Nasser. Very best of luck with the play, which opens soon in London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, finally, it's 9:06. Son, see, family and friends, what could be nicer than taking the people whose company you love on holiday with you? Well, quite a loss, it seems. 2 weeks in August is the new BBC drama that offers an unflinching look at the reality of group summer holidays.
Who's in that room?
I don't know.
Bet you it's Sol and Jess.
Yeah, could be.
You always get the big room. I think they got here early to bag you.
Well, we had to get the later flight, didn't we?
Yeah, well, I know we had to get the cheapest flight. Thank you.
And Jess bought the villa, so.
Yeah, somewhere we can barely afford. And it's so typical of Jess to make everyone split the cost and then do the best out of it.
We can always swap in a few days.
Like, no one in the history of the world has ever swapped rooms during a holiday.
Yes, it brings back horrific memories. Who stole the best room? Who bought the expensive wine we didn't agree to pay for? Who threw my child's toys in the river? Lisa Minot, travel editor of The Sun, and Zoe Williams, Guardian columnist, are here to share the joy of that shared family experience. Zoe, did that bring horrific memories back?
Well, I mean, I don't have horrific memories because I've been going away with the same people for more than 20 years. But definitely you have to have the same attitudes to money, I would say. Otherwise, it's never going to work. And you have to have the right balance of uptight people and people who don't care. If you don't have those things, you're sunk.
But parenting really stretches it, doesn't it? Because you suddenly discover people you think you're alike treat their children completely differently to the way you treat yours.
Yeah, you'll never be under more scrutiny as a parent and in a relationship than you are on holiday, because people can see it all the time. They can see everything all the time. And again, it smooths out a lot of these wrinkles if the kids get on. Parents will put up with anything so long as their kids are getting on and they're all playing nicely.
Lisa, have your group holidays been this blissful?
Yes, they have been blissful. Oh, I've been really? Going to the same. I've been going to the same campsite in the south of France for 50 years. Start with my parents, and then with my children. But that's not to say that we haven't had some corkers of some rows over the years. You know, particularly when you talk about multi-generational holidays. You know, the way that I parent my children and the way that my parents parented me are very different. And there's been some rows over the years about that and about the way that we are very different in the way we're bringing up our children. But I wouldn't miss it for the world, because my children have made friends in the south of France with the children that I met when I was a child. And that continuation and the fact that they have this amazing sort of international crowd that they've grown up with their whole lives, I think it makes up for every single row
now
that we
might
possibly
blissful,
have had.
But isn't there a problem when you decide, well, are we having a lie-in this morning, or are we sort of off yomping, doing some exercise first thing?
I think that's very much the case that, as you say, with your different friends, your different family members are the same. My sister loves yoga on the beach at sunrise. I would like to stay in bed. The joy of a family holiday, I think, is the fact that you do actually know each other that well enough that you can go, you do you, we're going to do ourselves as well. It's about making sure that you're sharing the right connected times and not all the time.
Part of the problem, Zoe, is there's huge pressure, isn't there, for particularly for people who are hard-pressed. This is a lot of money. They're desperate for a rest if they're parents. So it's got to work.
Well, yeah, I mean, nothing's supposed to happen on holiday, so everything does happen on holiday. And we've had like multiple divorces, multiple bereavements, multiple near car crashes. Like, it's the most dramatic thing of our entire year.
A minute ago, you were telling me how blissful it was.
Well, I mean, you know, those things are bound to happen in a life. You want them to happen with your friends there. But actually, it's the little stuff, you know. We've had other couples in with our gang and they can't stand the way we spend the whole time in a supermarket and chopping onions. There was one couple who kind of woke up every morning going, no, they're chopping again.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
kind of so, just actually the mores that they can't, that like really grate on each other.
Lisa, brief final word to you. Other than the divorces, the car crashes and the rows, it's all great.
It is, because sitting on a beach with my friends and family, sharing pizza, sharing some lovely bottles of rosé, looking out to the sea, there's nothing in the world that can beat that.
Well, have wonderful holidays. I'm about to go on mine. So
I'm sort of terrified for you and your family.